Thank you very much. Time now is 9:30 on the clock, and therefore we may as well start with our meeting so that we do not have to apologize for starting late. Let me then take this opportunity to welcome the Department of Police, led by General Labi, as well as the Independent Committee, in fact, IPED, led by the Executive Director, the Secretariat, led by the Civilian Secretary. We also are welcoming any member of the public this year, together with the media. We believe that this is one other important meeting that we are convening. But maybe before I say something about the meeting itself, I just want to start by saying again, a member of parliament, Honorable Tolo, was brutally murdered in his home and bedroom in the early hours of Monday last week. I'm saying this for the second time. He was buried last Sunday, and at his home, his younger brother told us that in that area, 8 other people had been murdered in almost the same way, and to date, nobody has been arrested. Even if it was difficult for me to follow what he was saying, because he speaks Pedi, which I personally do not understand, but I think and believe that this matter that he raised needs to be followed. It cannot be that you have up to 8 people murdered in an area like that one and nobody gets arrested. As a matter of fact, whether as individuals or as a portfolio committee, we will visit that police station. I can actually inform the department today. We will also follow Baba Dolo's case with keen interest. We do expect that the perpetrators of this crime will be arrested. For me, I think this is one case that is not difficult to effect an arrest. I think the perpetrators left a lot of evidence that, in fact, is supposed to assist the police in ensuring a very watertight case. Honorable members, Chapter 2, Section 7(1) of the Constitution states that the Bill of Rights is a cornerstone in South Africa. It enshrines the right of people in our country and affirms the democratic values of human dignity, equality, and freedom. Section 7(2) of the Constitution states that the state must respect, protect, promote, and fulfill the rights in the Bill of Rights. Section 12(1) of the Constitution states that everyone has the right to freedom and security of the person, which includes the right A, not to be deprived of freedom arbitrarily or without just cause, B, not to be detained without trial, C, to be free from all forms of violence from either public or private sources, D, not to be tortured in any way, and E, not to be treated or punished in a cruel, inhuman, and degrading way. Section 17 of the Constitution states that everyone has the right, peacefully and unarmed, to assemble, to demonstrate, to picket, and to present petitions. Section 36 of the Constitution states that the rights in the Bill of Rights may be limited only in terms of law of general application, to the extent that the limitation is reasonable and justifiable in an open and democratic society based on human dignity, equality, and freedom, taking into account all relevant factors, including A, the nature of the right, B, the importance of the purpose of the limitation, C, the nature and extent of the limitation, D, the relation between the limitation and its purpose, and D, less restrictive means to achieve the purpose. 36(2) states that except as provided in subsection 1 or in any other provision of the Constitution, no law may limit any right entrenched in the Bill of Rights. South Africa is a constitutional country, and the Constitution says the Bill of Rights is a cornerstone in South Africa. The issues we are here to discuss today talk to the core of our Constitution. Section 205(3) of the Constitution states that the objects of the police are to prevent, to combat, and investigate crime, to maintain public order, to protect and secure the inhabitants of the Republic and their property, and to uphold and enforce law. To uphold and enforce law. We thought that it is important to remind ourselves of these constitutional obligations that apply to law enforcement agencies such as SAPS, including as well all other citizens of the Republic. As a matter of fact, it is my right to choose not to participate in a demonstration, but equally it is my right to participate in a peaceful, unarmed demonstration. Realizing that we seem to be having or experiencing a growth in the number of protest marches that are sometimes accompanied by violence and criminality, and the police are expected by the Constitution to maintain public order, we thought it is important that the department tells us and the people of South Africa as to how it wants to deal with this important constitutional right people have, that of peaceful and unarmed demonstrations and presenting petitions. And when there is criminality and violence during a demonstration, as well as in cases where marches are illegal, we think that the department must explain as to how it will deal or it deals with these circumstances. During the FIFA World Cup, the department demonstrated to us on how it was going to deal with the crowds, including unruly crowds. We're really impressed. However, immediately after the World Cup, those skills seem to have disappeared. As a matter of fact, we have witnessed quite a number of extremely concerning scenarios. We therefore have decided that in order to deal with this subject, we need to have in one meeting a presentation from the ICD, from the Secretariat, as well as from the department. We have allocated 30 minutes for each presentation. Because we do not have adequate time to deal with these issues, we will allow presentations to continue, all of them, and then of course we'll then ask questions. We will take the presentation from the Civilian Secretariat for Police on the oversight role over SAPS regarding the implementation of crowd control strategy. Immediately after that, the IP will brief us on its role and findings in situations of crowd control intervention. And lastly, SAPS will brief us on the implementation of crowd control strategy. And this is how we will then make the presentation. In each one of us has got 30 minutes, and I will indeed stop a presenter if he goes or she goes beyond 30 minutes. Thank you very much, Secretary.
Thanks, Chair. Just to introduce the delegation from the Secretariat, I think you met them when we were here with the DPCI legislation. Dr. Matiba Pilani from our Policy and Research Unit, Director in our Policy and Research Unit, and Advocate Antong, who is Head of the Policy and Research Unit. In terms of our presentation, Chair, the first slide and the first section of the presentation deals with our role. But I think the second slide is the second section of the presentation is the more important section, because what has happened in terms of our role is that it is the role of the Civilian Secretariat for Police to develop policy, which is then submitted to the Minister, which once approved will become policy for the Department. And what has been happening over the last 6 months is that we have been working on a policy document looking at the manner in which we are policing public gatherings and our crowd control methods. We have also done extensive international reviews, etc., as part of that, which Advocate Anton will speak to. But if you look at our role, it's to conduct research, address best practices regarding policing of public protests and gatherings, to develop policy which, once approved by the Minister, will become official policy for the Department of Police, to monitor the implementation of policy, and to advise the Minister on further revisions and approaches to the policy requirements. So what we are going to be presenting to you today is a policy which has been developed, as I say, over the last 6 months, and which has been last week finalized with the Minister, and which we are now in the process of formalizing as a formal policy from the Minister. I'm going to ask Advocate Antong to just quickly take us through that process.
Thank you, Chairperson. Our presentation starts with the introduction. The dynamics in the policing of public protests in South Africa have, after 1994, undergone a major shift. Prior to 1994, the policing measures with regard to public protests were characterized by arbitrary riot control and abusive sanctions. Now, after 1994, there was an introduction of a community-orientated policing system, and this was strengthened by the Constitution and the Bill of Rights, which obviously had an impact on the policing approach. The transformation of the SAPS then also focused on the public policing order in terms of rationalizing some of the units into a proper constituted unit. However, serious gaps were identified within the policy. Within the operational policy, the establishment of POP units after 2001-2002 resulted in the formation of area crime combating units that obviously required a change in the mindset of the SAPS towards effective crowd control and management. Recently, the country has experienced a growth in the number of protest actions. In some instances, we have noted that it was accompanied by provocation, intimidation, public violence, and criminality. And therefore, the challenge is for the SAPS to respond to this in a manner that recognizes and balances the rights of citizens to protest and the need to ensure law and order is maintained. It is important to determine the extent to which public order policing conforms to legal imperatives and the approach to policing. Whether operational policies of the SAPS allow for appropriate planning interventions and or responses in respect of public gatherings and protests. One of the challenges facing the SAPS is how to balance the need for policing these gatherings and protests versus the SAPS roles regarding other police functions. Chair, the approach that the policy takes is basically around issues which is consistent with the constitutional accorded rights for individuals, effective and peaceful crowd control demands. It impacts negatively, if it impacts negatively and enhances tensions between the police and the community at the time of the process, so we need to address that situation and that manifestation. It generates the very violence it seeks to control in the public protests. The scope and objectives of the policy, it is to establish a framework with guidelines for the SAPS to also review and align the operational strategies and instructions that is inclusive of standing orders. The objectives is to create proper crowd control and management capacity, to introduce a framework with guidelines on policing of protest in line with international standards and instruments, introduction of training standards and addressing, amongst others, the principle of the first responder. I think this is one of the areas that have created lately some of the problems that we have experienced. Then the SAPS operational planning and response, the deployment of resources and the physical execution of such policing. Chair, the legislative and policy framework, as you have mentioned already, the Constitution, which contains the Bill of Rights, the Regulation of Gatherings Act 205 of 1993, South African Police Services Act 68 of 1995, as amended, the SAPS Standing Orders numbers 262, 292, and 293. We also quoted the Peace and Security Protocol, the Intergovernmental Relations Act, obviously in the local domain. And then we also touched on the United Nations basic principles on the use of force and firearms by law enforcement officials. The current policing environment, current norms and standards regulating the policing of public protests are covered by the Constitution, international, regional, and national laws and instruments. The key questions that comes up and the implications for the policing of public protests and gatherings include, amongst others, is the training of the SAPS currently still relevant and appropriate? That is both theoretical as well as practical. Does the training facilities that we have proper infrastructure, and does the equipment apply to the standards? Does the training module succeed in creating a common understanding of the Regulation of Gatherings Act, the standing orders, as well as whether it creates a situation where trainees or delegates who are nominated for training, whether they are exposed to real-time or real situations, which would obviously be in the form of simulations? And then, who is policing the protests? Because there seems to be a lot of confusion around that. I think later it will become clear what we are saying there. Then the planning, implementation, and command and control during public protests. So just international perspective and comparison, we have indicated the United Nations, how they approach some of these situations. Law enforcement agencies must adopt and maintain rules and regulations on the use of force, subject to constant review. The country dynamics dictate which approach is best suited for the police in crowd management. We have looked at countries like Britain, Italy, France, Sweden, North Ireland, Belgium, Spain, Germany, the United States of America, and Scotland, where they apply mechanical force. This basically involves the use of some devices or substance, baton or other object, canine, physical contact with a subject or natural agent spraying, other than the firearm, to overcome a subject's resistance to the exertion of authority. Chair, in terms of the environment that the policy needs to be implemented, the South African context The operational policing strategy must take into account the operational environment based upon sound democratic principles without infringing on the human rights of citizens, including those not part of protests, bystanders and people who are at that moment also in the vicinity. The policy establishes a framework for the policing of public protests and calls for the introduction of strict measures on the use to reduce use of force during public protest to the minimum. Policy and guidelines must inform SERPs' operational strategies in the policing of public protests while restoring trust and confidence in communities, as I've mentioned, whether as protesters or whether as bystanders. There's a need to inculcate a common understanding of the Regulation of Gatherings Act. There is obviously amongst the police themselves and other agencies, they don't seem to have a clear understanding and as common in terms of what is the objectives. Alignment of standing orders 262, 292 and 293 to international best practice and the public gatherings, effective crowd and management control. We are not saying that these standing orders are totally out of line. We say that it might need some alignment in terms of what the international perspective is and in terms of the standards. And there's a need to introduce proper sanctions for non-compliance and adherence. The policing of public protests. Che referred to the World Cup, Soccer World Cup. Initially, when training and the approach towards the FIFA World Cup, there was a decision to use the French model, which eventually also included training by some French experts who came and assisted with training towards policing during the World Cup. That is for event control, major event control, as well as policing. If we look at the SEPS model, it's more biased towards the Belgium model that have been used all along. So as indicated, after the FIFA World Cup, the training did not continue, whereas there's a fallback to the Belgium model. It will become later clear what the Belgium model is. It is also imperative that the SAPS align itself with the following key issues as crucial areas for intervention and redress. The first one is the establishment of a dedicated and, may I say, national public order policing unit. The training of members attached to the public order policing unit, issues around command and control, operational planning and types of in terms of the types of public protests, the use of force in terms of how do we minimize casualties and fatalities, the use of correct equipment and to ensure that those are there, and the use of crime intelligence in terms of the planning. The first issue, Chair, is the establishment of a dedicated public order policing unit. In terms of Section 17 of the South African Police Services Act, the National Commissioner shall establish and maintain a National Public Order Policing Unit. Currently, there are some units that is in operation, but it resorts under the Operational Response Services, and then mostly functioning in the provinces. So there's a need that we need to relook at it, because there's some gap in terms of the provincial and the national. It creates problems in terms of command and control. Although the members this unit should be properly capacitated and resourced. We saw during the FIFA World Cup that a lot of equipment have been purchased, and it is also now incumbent to see how do we distribute some of those and also then supplement and complement some of these resources. Although members of these units may be utilized for other duties, as the case may be in terms of the current ORS approach, where they also do crime combating functions. The very first and or the primary function should be public order policing, whereas they can also then be utilized for others. But they should also be readily available when required for deployment to problematic areas. The public order policing unit should take command and control of public disturbances. That is in all cases where there's such a situation. We find that some agencies, and even within the SAPS, between the different levels, there seems to be problematic in terms of managing these situations. And also the members must be appropriately trained. Chairperson, the training of the members in public order policing, there's a need to look at the current training facilities and the standards, and they should be upgraded and or renovated. We have found that after 2007, after restructuring, that there was a slight move away from the specialized training to a more generalist crowd control management and training. The modules must equip the SAPS members with appropriate capacity in dealing with public protests. I've mentioned theoretical as well as practical. And all POP units must undergo this training. Training must also prepare individuals to deal with any situation. And here, if you look at the international perspective, is that the personality of such a member also plays a big role. Because people who are going and they find themselves in this situation, it's normally how I react that spark a response from the crowd. So it's very important to look also at the attributes of our members when they go to such instances. All trainers must be accredited and be competent to provide accredited training. In this regard, we were referring to the French training that was provided during the World Cup. It was very effective, and we need to use maybe also some of those trainers in terms of how do we take it forward. There was some, during our research, there were some observations from some of the researchers that training deliberations currently, it doesn't seem to be a clear distinction between commissioned and non-commissioned officers. They all go for training, and in terms of simulation exercises, it's like in the spur of the moment when I'm on this topic, I just start and I simulate and I try to spark some response. We are also saying that general training for other SAPS officials at station level, and this it should be included in the manuals as basic training. These are normally at station level. This is and especially the visible policing members. They are normally people, especially in the instance of spontaneous or unplanned protests. They are normally the first responders. So they need to be equipped when they get to such situations. How do I react? How do I read the situation and call in and make a proper assessment and give feedback in terms of reinforcements? Training must include understanding of the legal environment. Commanders of units should be trained in negotiation techniques. This one is very important also, so that our commanders must be able to identify appropriate people and call them, and so that they can negotiate and see whether there's no compromise that can be reached. But also in terms of informing crowds, what will be some of the consequences. Chairperson, in terms of the operational planning, I've already mentioned that public protests can take shape either as planned or unplanned protests. We have currently legislation that's dealing with the public protest. Section 4 of the Regulation of Gatherings Act, meetings should be attended by senior officers who must or can make input and take decisions. This should include the actual officer who will take command and control responsibilities that they actually did. And in this case, if the public order policing unit is there, it will be crucial that a specialized member from this unit must attend some of these meetings. Operational planning must always include a proper assessment of the environment, right, and it must guide the deployment of resources and, when necessary, make provision for possible reinforcements. Provinces, through the POPS units, must facilitate the development of contingency plans to provide minimum guidance on procedures to be followed should any of the protest types manifest. This must also deal with how first officers on the scene respond. This is the first responder. There is currently, it's becoming a discretion. How do we react if this thing just pops up? I'm in the street and here I find 100 or 200 people, and how do I react? So that is also some of the situations where we say that at least there must be contingency plans to say, in such a situation, how do we react? And it should not be spontaneous, but there should be some guidelines. The SAPS must introduce measures to ensure the proper cordoning off of areas in its restricting protest to routes and areas less significant, and minimum opportunity for damage to property or threats to the person. In this case, if you look at international models, British, French, what they do is they would guide the routes of the protest, they will then contain the situation to ensure that people end up at another spot instead of where they wanted to be, and may cause some damage there. The command and control, the success of effective response by the SAPS to any public protest situation is dependent on a strong line of command and control. There should be clear line understanding of different responsibilities, clear procedures on how to police protest and the use of barricades and police lines as opposed to scattered deployment. The platoon leader must be guided by the operational commander, who is normally situated some blocks away in most instances in a different spot, mobile or permanent command center. And these situations also sometimes create problems, because what happens if they lose communication between the operational members who are at the scene as well, and the commander is sitting elsewhere. Unit commanders must ensure that the SAP 15s are completed before every intervention by the public order policing units, including the capturing of serial numbers of firearms, shotguns, etc. And the members must have all the necessary equipment. Commanders must certify the issuing of such equipment. In this case, also there must be name tags, must be properly displayed, and so forth. The policing of public protests must be solely the responsibility of the SAPS. We have currently also municipal police services, and especially in this regard, it becomes problematic to contain and manage these situations, because the Metro Police will show up and they are under a different line of control. They might use other ammunition as what is prescribed by the SAPS, and that also creates problems in terms of who's taking responsibility for what. So we are saying that the SAPS, in this regard, when they arrive at the scene, the specialized unit, they have the proper planning, the police must take over control, and other agencies will have to slot into that or do what they're supposed to do. There must be regular briefings and deep briefings. It is essential to ensure that throughout the process and the events, there is proper planning, and planning is aligned for whatever contingency that can come up. Chair, in terms of the responsibility of event organizers, I don't think currently there's a lot of emphasis on these aspects. It is mostly the policing, but if you look at some of the legislation, it puts also obligations on the organizers and the conveners. And in most instances, these people fail those obligations and creates then further problems. Now, while the police have a responsibility to police protest gatherings and events, the Gathering Act places considerable responsibility on organizers of events to ensure that such events are carried out in an orderly and peaceful manner. Organizers must be able to show at the Section 4 meeting that they have and are able to deploy sufficient marshals during the gathering and the event. The organizers should have a person who is able to liaise with the police to address any problems that may arise during the gathering or the event. Where the gathering spends more than one day, and this is also important, the organizers of the gathering must be available to meet with the SAPS to do on a daily basis or at the end of the day proper appreciation and review of what happened during the day, and they must decide then on what should be the following steps for the next day. Also the role of negotiating with commanders, I think this one is also not very much emphasized during this time that we are finding ourselves in. The SAPS commanders must make use of the skills, and they should be able to use the skills during the gatherings. In the case of planned gatherings, the commanders must be able to negotiate with organizers as and when required. In the event of unplanned gathering, the commanding officers must be able to, they should also have that skill to identify people from the crowd that they ought to be some of the leaders in which they can get into talks with. Chair, in terms of the use of force at public gatherings, the international instruments have indicated. The standing order currently prescribes the kind of, this is standing order 262, the kind of weapons and ammunition allowed to be used during public protests or gatherings and must be adhered to. Any instruction to discharge a firearm must be subject to review and investigation. A decision to discharge a firearm should be on the order or orders of the commander. Members should at all times be issued with protective body armor, helmets, shields, batons, and other equipment. And the trend also internationally is that before resorting to other use of weapons, water cannons are used to disperse the crowds. The standing orders for the policing of public gatherings should be compiled into a manual that is easy to read and accessible to all police officials involved in protest gatherings and events. In terms of the equipment, in order to give effect to the implementation of this policy, it is incumbent on the SAPS management to, when necessary, kickstart procurement processes in ensuring that all the required and necessary equipment is procured, evenly distributed and allocated, and that that proper maintenance measures should be introduced. We are just touching here on some of the equipment that should be available at all times. The body armor is used in some of the international or the countries abroad. Helmets, shields, batons, water cannons. We know that during the FIFA World Cup there were some procured, and it's to decide where do we deploy these in order to respond when it's required, and how do we, where do we place them. It is required that the above should be available at all major events, but in addition, each commander should do an appreciation of the situation, which must inform his or her decision on the deployment of resources. Mobile command centers must be able to be deployed when necessary. Chairperson, on the issue of intelligence and information, a threat analysis must be conducted by the intelligence fraternity throughout the whole country to identify hotspots, which must be considered and provide guidance for the deployment and or allocation of equipment. The use of intelligence as part of policing public protests is essential and should not be underestimated. Intelligence must play a role in planning, deployment, and operations of the public order policing unit. Intelligence must be able to identify key risks during the protest and liaise with commanders regarding these risks. For example, the isolation of key individuals from the crowd and also some of the other methods used internationally, like snatches and so forth. All such gatherings should be videoed. This was done previously, but it just stopped. And the argument is that these can be used later for investigations that needs to be completed, as well as identifying people who might have been involved in some criminal activity. Chair, I think this is the presentation. I'm just going to ask the secretary. I think there's just one or two things she wants to add. Thank you.
Chair, I think the policy hinges on a proper effective POP unit being established and being properly trained and able to be deployed rapidly at all situations. I think we will give you a copy of the policy document, which also looks at issues like distance policing of crowds. If you park vehicles sporadically all over the place, you can't control a crowd. The international practices about how close you are to the crowd when you actually need to policing, all of that stuff is in the policy, which we will give you a copy of.
Thank you very much, Secretary, for the presentation. I know that members already have questions, but let us allow the ICD to make its presentation. 30 minutes.
Thank you very much, Chairperson. I just want to introduce the delegation. We've got Mr. Matthew Sisoko, the Acting Provincial Head in Mpumalanga, Mr. Rizani Madao, Head of Information Services, Mr. Khamanyane, the Provincial Head in the Free State, Mr. Moses Lavini, who's our Senior Manager IMS, and Mr. Thabo Leola of the Western Cape. Maybe just to indicate that we have taken note of the issues raised by the Chairperson and the Portfolio Committee members at the Portfolio Committee meeting of 14 June, and we have taken that also forward in terms of our presentation. In terms of the issues, we will go quickly in terms of the time allocation. The first slide really deals with the constitutional mandate of the ICD in terms of the constitution. I think members are well in favour of that. Then in terms of the current legislation mandate, just to indicate again that recommendations that are currently made by ICD is not compulsory to be followed by the South African police. Then if we look at the new mandate of the IFET, it's important to note that there's various categories of compulsory investigative matters that have a bearing on crowd control matters and that we will have to investigate. That will be, of course, be any deaths in police custody, deaths as a result of police action, any complaint of torture or assault against the police officer in the execution of his or duties. Just to indicate that most of the complaints that we received during this past 2 years is really with deal with assault. And then any other matter also referred to us. In the indication of the effect of the IPET Act that we believe would contribute to the more effective investigation of these matters, the first issue is the question of reporting obligations. The station commander or any member of the SAPS or MPS must immediately after becoming aware notify the directorate of any matter that must be investigated by the directorate, and then within 24 hours hereafter submit a written report to the directorate in the prescribed form and manner of any such matter. The delegation is also available today for any questions with regard to those cases that happened in Ermelo as well as Fuchsburg, Hamburg, Balfour, Reichenpark, as well as Silverkrantz. Matters, the issues that we have come across there that is difficult for us to investigate. Then in terms also of the effect of the IPET Act, cooperation by SAPS and the MPS, the members of the SAPS or MPS must provide their full cooperation to the directorate, including but not limited to the arrangement of identification parade within 48 hours of the request made by the directorate, the availability of members for the taking of an affidavit or an affirmed declaration, or to give evidence or produce any document in that member's possession, or under his or her control which has a bearing on the matter being investigated, and then any other information or documentation required for investigation purposes. Another issue that we think is very important as well in terms of our cooperation with the National Secretariat is that Section 17B of the IPET Act makes provision for discussion, amongst others, of issues relating to trends, recommendations, and implementations of such recommendations. So we believe that forum will also assist and contribute to a situation where our recommendations would be addressed. Chairperson, that is about the future. We're going to ask then the next presenter, Mr. Dlamini, to talk about the past and the present.
Chairperson, honorable members, ladies and gentlemen, I'll take you through the statistics that is from slide number 9. You would note that from 2002 to 2011, the ICD received 204 complaints involving crowd management or control issues. You'd note that most of them were assault with GBH, with 87 cases out of the 204, and then deaths that occurred as a result of the incident, numbered 52, and attempted murder complaints that we received, numbered 55. You'd note an increase starting in 2007, and then especially 2009, when we had 59 incidents. So I've dealt with slide number 9 and 10. We go to slide number 11 and 12. There, Chairperson, we break down those complaints, those 204 complaints, per province. You would note that out of 204, we received 77 from Mpumalanga. And there, 60 cases were assault, and then you had other 12 deaths that occurred there. And then the Gauteng accounted for 24, and Western Cape 21, Northwest 20 complaints. Other provinces accounted for a smaller number of cases. If I go to slides number 13 and 14, it's a graphical representation. You would see that the graph sort of flattens out up until 2006. Then from 2007, it shoots up, peaking at 59 in 2009, and then comes down in 2010. 2011, it's in the third quarter, we already have 40 cases. So it may actually go up by the end of 2011. Again, most of the cases are cases of assault. If we go to the next two slides, 15 and 16, you would note that now there we look at the units that against whom complaints were made. You would note that most of the incidents involved station members from the various police stations, 68 cases, but then the next figure is public order policing, working jointly with the station members, 45 cases, and then in 27 cases, it's the COPS intervention unit, TRT, working together, there are 27 cases, and you would note that those all occurred in Mpumalanga. And then in some instances, we also had Metro Police and station members. If I may, in slide number 16, most of the victims who were involved in protest marches, that is 59%. And then other people who made complaints alleged that they were not involved in any protest or demonstrations. In some instances, it's incidents where police were raiding taverns and so on. In slide number 17 and 18, you would note that out of the 204 cases, 85 completed, the investigations were completed, 79 closed, and then you still have about 39 cases still under investigation. In terms of the 79 cases that are closed, if I may elaborate, 64 resulted in prosecution, and 75 were closed as unsubstantiated, as members could not be identified. I think we have in the past also alluded to the challenges of investigating such cases, and we will try and elaborate what the challenges we are facing. In terms of the criminal recommendations, in 48% of the cases, no recommendations were made, and in of those that are completed, and in 52% recommendations for criminal prosecution were made. If I go to slide number 21, there we're looking at departmental recommendations. In 92% of the cases, no departmental recommendations were made, and in 8% were recommendations made for police to take further action against the members. Again, the challenges of investigating such cases. If I go to slide number 23 and 24, in 62% of the cases or the complaints, they were made by the victims, and then in 38%, the complaints were came from third party complainants who were complaining on behalf of family, family who were either assaulted or died as a result of police action. Mr. Sissoko will then talk to the challenges and recommendations that we have looked at. Thank you.
Thank you, Chairperson, honorable members, ladies and gentlemen. We looked at the holistic view of all the cases that we've investigated and the challenges that we've met in investigating those cases, and we also suggest recommendations. One of the challenges we identified was the identification of members involved in the crowd control situation and incident, including shooting, assaults, and arrests. And our recommendation in that regard is that unit commanders must ensure that the SAP 15s are completed before every intervention by the public order policing units, including serial numbers of firearms, shotguns, number of live rounds, rubber bullets, and the members are carrying tear gas, pepper sprays, and any equipment, including helmets. And commanders must certify the issuing of such equipment. I think this will sit in line with what the Secretariat has also indicated in their presentation. But we're also saying that because in some situations you find that these protests are unplanned. In those situations, you're saying the station commander in that jurisdiction must take control until the public order policing arrives in that situation. We also think there's an issue with regard to training of members in respect of crowd dispersing and crowd management. And our recommendation is that SAPS must provide updated training to members of public order policing, and these members must be trained on a regular basis on current international practices. But we're also saying that because sometimes members from the station must also be in an unplanned situation, members from the station are supposed to get involved in these situations. Those members must also be provided with at least a basic training in this regard. Another challenge is lack of information to hold identification parades. And here again, we talk about the SAP 15, which we're saying when these SAP 15s are properly completed and they've got the detailed information about members and the equipment and everything that will be used in that situation, it will be easier for us. It will help us in terms of identification parade. And also other challenges that go with identification parades, I think the executive director has alluded to in terms of the EPID Act, that the Act also addresses those issues. There is also a challenge in terms of unions or other members that get involved in unplanned strikes or marches. In this situation, you find that when there is an unplanned march, you find unions or members coming from different stations and go to a particular jurisdiction to come and help in that situation. And then it raises also a problem in terms of command and control. And you're saying that these members must report to the station commander or the commander of the public order policing unit or on duty in that event. The other challenge is the cooperation from members of the SAPS and Metro Police. And our recommendation here is that senior members and commanders involved in any crowd control management must be compelled to assist the independent complaints directorate or EPIC in any investigation arising from such crowd control management situation. Another challenge is the dress code of members during activities involving the crowd. And our recommendation is that members must be easily identifiable. Name tags must be visible, and their bulletproof vest must be marked with visible numbers. The helmet worn by members of the public order policy must be clearly marked with numbers and handed to identified members. A similar identification mark should also be developed for other police members deployed to crowd control. And here we're saying, most of these cases you find that members of the community say we could not identify members because they were wearing helmets and so forth. And we're saying if they are wearing helmets, for instance, that helmet should have a mark so that a member of the public can be able to say a police member who shot me, for instance, was wearing a helmet with a number so and so. So it's easier for them to identify those members. Another challenge we identified is difficult in calling off crime scene. Most of this situation, you find that when you are called in to attend these scenes, you find that the situation sometimes still volatile. It becomes difficult for ICD investigators to also access the scene. And our recommendation here is that the area must probably call in off using barbed wire as a method to secure the scene. So we're saying here, and I think it's also in line with what the Secretariat has also indicated in their presentation in terms of cutting off the area where there are incidents of crowd control. Another challenge you identify is identifying members using crowd control equipment. We're saying here that the need for police to procure crowd management equipment that can be linked to specific users. Here we're talking about a situation, for instance, where people say they've been shot with rubber bullets and so forth, and were unable to link those rubber bullets, for instance, to a specific handgun that was used to, by any member. In fact, we were not even able to say who was using what equipment. So this goes back to also what the Secretary alluded to, that you need to have a situation where when members are deployed, these SAP 15 are able to say what member is having what equipment. And all these equipment that are used are easily identifiable. If it's a rubber bullet, for instance, SAPS must maybe look at their procurement system and see if it's possible that they can procure equipment that can be easily identified. If you, a shot was made, for instance, with a shotgun, it's possible that rubber bullet can also be marked so that when it's picked at the scene, it can be able to be linked to a particular a shotgun and be linked to a specific member. The other issues that we are referring to earlier with regard to helmets, for instance, that I clearly have identifiable marks. They are bulletproof vests that have clear identifiable marks also. And then we're saying also the challenge, the lack of crowd control equipment at police station. And as a recommendation, we say police station must be stocked with minimum crowd control equipment to be able to respond appropriately to unplanned events. And here we're talking about situations where there is an unplanned event, we find that members at the station are expected to go and control the situation before the cops arrive. whilst they were provided with the shotguns, but they were provided shotguns without rubber bullets because they didn't have stock of rubber bullets at the station. In the Northwest, for instance, members said they ran out of rubber bullets, so they had to use live ammunition. So these are the challenges that you have to make sure that the station have adequate equipment for crowd control in terms of this unplanned event. As another challenge is lack of post-event reports. We're saying as a recommendation that commanders must be responsible for preparing detailed crowd control reports, which must be made available to ICD for investigation purposes. And here we're saying that there must be accountability by members who are taking control of this protest. And therefore, after they finished with the process situation, they must compile these reports, detailed reports, which must then be provided to us for investigation purposes. And this will also help us in terms of investigation. And here we're also saying this should also include, for instance, the videotaping, that we must get the videotapes that shall have been captured for that event. I mean, we also say that it's very important that each and every event must be videotaped, and so that we are able to get the videotape, which will also be able to help us in terms of identifying which members were involved and what specific action was done by each member. The other issue that we have identified is the issue of lack of command and control. And as a recommendation here, we say members involved in camp control situations must only act on instruction and direction of a commander, and commanders need additional training must be able to provide good command and control throughout the operation. I think the cases that we've alluded to, I mean, the Tetane matter is also an example of those matters where there's a lack of command and control, where members end up acting on their own without giving specific command by their commanders. In a Silver Crown matter, for instance, in Northwest, members also acted and shot using live rounds, and you find that there is no commander who takes responsibility for that. And each and every commander will say, no, but I did not give that instruction. Then the question is then, how did members use their live ammunition on the protesters without having been given that kind of instruction by their commander? So it clearly shows that there is an issue with regard to command and control. I think that is the presentation. Thank you, Chair.
Your Chairperson, just in closure, we are of the opinion from our viewpoint that the IPED Act creates a new oversight framework to ensure that the investigations of these matters can be done more effectively. We also believe the consideration of international best practice for SAPS and ourselves, and also the consideration of recommendations from IPED in the forum with the Secretariat, can play a valuable role in addressing those issues, and in the review of standing operating procedures by SAPS can also contribute to it. Thank you, Chair.
Thank you very much,
IPED
Chair. We will move on to SAPS.
Honourable Chairperson, the Honourable Members of the Portfolio Committee, good morning. May I first introduce the delegation from the South African Police Service. I'm Lieutenant General Levia, the Deputy National Commissioner for Crime Detection. With me, I'm accompanied by Lieutenant General Mawila. He is the Divisional Commissioner of Operational Response Service. With him is Major General Mukwanazi. He is the head of special operations, and then at the other side is Brigadier Gibson. He is the section head of public order policy. We also have got Lieutenant Colonel Stein, who is the administrative officer. Honorable members, we have noted what the prescript of section 205, subsection 3 of the Constitution is saying with specific environment where I shall underline to maintain among others, public order. From practical experience, we have come to understand that most disputes are never resolved before demonstration in public arena, where they are designed to attract public attention and seek some sympathy, be it in the form of salary increment or otherwise, be it a service delivery, be it for or against the granting of bail protests, to name but a few. These honorable members generate a number of policy assignments that we have to deal with. The overwhelming majority of this activity goes smoothly. In policing these activities, honorable members, we always keep in mind of the prescript of the Constitution with specific the Bill of Rights, Section 17 and 18, which provide that everyone has the right to peacefully and unarmed assemble, demonstrate, to picket, to present petitions, and that everyone has the right to freedom of association, which obviously include freedom of dissociation. We have to ensure that there is a harmonious equilibrium that has to be maintained. When the rights of participants or non-participants are violated or threatened, it becomes the responsibility of the South African police, where we have to step in. At times, these interventions divert attention or focus to the police. Appreciating that there is an average of no less than 1,000 demonstrations per annum in each province, our interventions suggest that less than a mere percent of the total incidents may have left us wanting. Indeed, we always conduct a debriefing where we, on an armchair situation, critically evaluate our overall policing of each event. Madam Chair, allow me at this stage to now hand over to Lieutenant General Mawela to take us through our presentation.
Thank you, General. Good morning, Madam Chair and honorable members of the committee. Let me continue with my presentation. The scope of my presentation will entail the following: the purpose, the mandate, the background, measures implemented, resources, activities and successes, challenges and conclusion. The purpose of my presentation, Madam Chair, honorable members, is to brief the portfolio committee on what measures have been taken to ensure that SAPS members are efficient in management of crowds and the challenges which we encountered in the enforcement of the Regulation of Gathering Act, Act 205 of 1993. With regard to our mandate, Madam Chair, allow me to correct the first bullet there. We're actually referring to Act 108 of 1996, not Act 200 of 1993. The Section 205, Subsection 3 of the Constitution, Act 108 of 1996, as the chairperson have alluded in her opening remarks, that the object of the SAPS is to prevent crime, investigation of crime, and amongst the others is the maintenance of public order. It also goes further, whereby, let me also correct the last bullet there on the same slide, whereby it talks about the National Commissioner subject to Section 218, subsection 1, in bracket K, instead of F, of the Interim Constitution. It therefore gives the mandate to the National Commissioner to maintain the national public order police capacity to maintain public order, as alluded by the Secretariat, that there is a need to establish the national capacity to deal with public order measures. Coming to the background, Madam Chair, honorable members, some of the changes which we went through as the South African Police Service, it came with positive, some with negative consequences. Here I am trying to explain what happened during the transformation which was going through in the SAPS, in particular to the Public Order Police Units. 1995, we had 42 units comprising of 11,000 members. And their primary function then, it was crowd management. The secondary function, it was crime prevention. That was in 1995. Then we go again for the changes in the year 2002, the way changes now. We no longer have public order police units, but we now had the ACCU, the Area Crime Combating Unit. And it was 42 units comprising of 7,327 members. When the area offices were done with, in the year 2006, here we go again, we changed to crime combating units. And it was now reduced to 23 units comprising of 2,595 members. The year 2011, we are now sitting at 11 units nationally, comprising of 4,343. And the primary function of this unit, 31 units, I'm sorry, thank you. That is the POPS unit now, which we are re-establishing. And the primary function is crime prevention, that includes the combating of crime, and the secondary function is crowd management, as alluded by our colleague from the Secretariat. Madam Chair and honorable members, these changes came with its own challenges. Among the others, it has changed our focus in terms of training, because the primary function was no longer crowd management. Then our members, they were subjected to training which is relevant to crime prevention. And again, to capacitate those members, the equipment thereof was no longer relevant to dealing with the crime situation, with the crowd situation, but more on crime prevention. And as a result, some of the procured equipment used then, when we were focusing mainly on crowd management, were no longer being maintained. Those are the challenges which we have encountered, or the negative consequences of the changes which we went through. The next slide, Madam Chair and honorable members, this is the strength of the public order units we are having countrywide. It shows there that Gauteng, we are having 3 units, whereby Johannesburg is comprising of total 323 members, Pretoria 286, Springs 271. It goes as listed in those slides. And the next slide, it also shows how many members do we have in various units in KwaZulu-Natal, Northwest. The next slide, it's Free State, Western Cape, Mpumalanga, Northern Cape. With regard to the activities whereby our units were involved during the year 2010-2011, that is the ACCUs, now changed to POPs. For all crowd management which went on peacefully, we had 11,681 gatherings, which were managed by the CCUs, and then it went peacefully. And whereby there was unrest in those crowd management, we had 972 gatherings. And other unrest, as alluded by my colleagues, the unplanned one or the spontaneous one, as we say in the police language, we had 629 gatherings. And the escort duties which these units have performed during the FIFA World Cup, among the others escorting the teams and all the delegates which were there, we had 1,551 escorts. Total activities which we handled during the year 2010 and 2011, it was 14,833. The arrest effected by this unit during the same period, whereby the members that were involved in crime prevention activities, they managed to effect 39,020 arrests. And arrests which are related to crowd management, it was 3,266 people who were arrested. Madam Chair, I will try to expand in the later slide about the arrests which were effected, which are related to crowd management, the challenges which we are encountering after effecting those arrests. And in support of other, not departments, other police units to come and arrest, for example, the crime intelligence, they may have identified the suspect elsewhere, and then they request the public order members to come and assist them. We had managed managed to can arrest 814 persons. And other arrests were, by the way, doing the normal day-to-day operations, and they've managed to arrest 203 persons. In total, 43,303 people were arrested by the ECCUs. In terms of our resource allocation guide, the approved structure as it stands now, Madam Chair and Honourable Member, is that we are expected to have 5,661 members nationwide. And the actual number which we are having currently is 4,343, running short of 330. This shortage, it was due to those changes which I have alluded to, and also the upward and vertical and horizontal mobility of the members, promotion, transfer, and so forth. And some other members whereby health-wise they felt that they cannot keep on working in this demanding environment, so they requested to be taken elsewhere. But we are working flat out to ensure that we recruit, ensure that the units are fully capacitated. And amongst the others, these are the members whom we have recruited from the Public Order Police Unit to establish the TRTs. Coming to the resources, Madam Chair and Honourable Members, nationally we have 546 armored vehicles, and then we have 299 personnel carriers. These are the kumbis, these are the buses which we use to ferry the members to their deployment areas. The LDVs, the vans, we have 496 sedans. We have 75 water cannon, which we bought before the Soccer World Cup. It is 10. The next slide, Madam Chair and Honourable Members, it talk about the reserve capacity which we have in our mobilization centre. This reserve capacity, we utilize it for rapid deployment. In case there is a problem in another province and we mobilize members from various stations and we deploy to go and support that particular province or station area, then we issue them with this equipment which is listed here, which we kept that at our mobilization center for rapid deployment. That is the helmet and the mask, 100, the gloves, 100, the body protection, 100, overalls, 100, shields, tomfer, and video cameras we don't have. It was also mentioned that there is a need for us to have the video machine to ensure that all activities are recorded accordingly. But Madam Chair and Honourable Members, in some units they do have the video cameras, they do have, even though it is the old one, the smaller Nyana ones, and there was no means to try to buy them the recent machine. Since I've said that some of the changes which we went through, it has impacted on capacity building. It was not the focus for us to can upgrade those equipment. But now we know, and it is our priority to ensure that members are issued with those video machines. Thank you, Madam Chair. The measures which we have taken to ensure that the SAPS members are efficient in management of the crowd. After we have realized, we have taken note and we know we have seen all the incidents which were happening in the country. And surely we didn't appreciate what was happening. Then we felt that we can't sit in our laurels and do nothing about that. It was the concern for the SAPS. We immediately jumped and started to do something to correct the situation. Because as a country, we went a long way to create or to maintain that relationship, the good relationship between the police and the citizens out there, the community. We can't afford to can destroy that relationship now by starting to work in a way in which it is not acceptable to the broader community. These are the measures which we put in place. I'll expand on that. That adherence to the goals and the principles and the continuous recruitment and selection, the training and the intervention which we brought about after we realized that things are falling apart. The goals for the crowd and management, we have ensured that we need to standardize the procedures in the ACPS to manage the crowd. We have realized that members in various provinces, this one they deal in the crowd situation in their own manner, this province, they have their own way of dealing with it. So we said we need to have a standardized way whereby every member of the South African Police Service, whatever corner of the country he may be, he must ensure or she must ensure that we deal with crowd issues in the same way. We have developed that kind of a standing operating procedure. Coming to the principle, Madam Chair, in your opening remark, you spoke about the constitutional rights of the community and so forth. We observed it. And we know that we have to, according to the constitutional rights of the individual, we have no choice on that. It's a legal obligation upon ourselves that we need to do that. And we have called upon all our commanders to ensure that we bring it, we drill it in their heads again to say that this, it is a legal obligation. We must adhere to that. We need to uphold the law. And acknowledging the rights of the citizens, being firm and impartial. When we're dealing with the crowd management, we will be firm, but at the same time, we ensure that we don't override the rights of the citizens or the rights of the people to express themselves in the form of the protest and so forth. And at all times, every day, we need to be professional. These are the principles which we have built in our national instructions, that our members, they have to adhere to that. Coming to recruitment, selection, and training, as it was alluded by both my colleagues to say that training, it is the concern. Yes, we also agree on that. And we say we will be recruiting from the basic police training, and we will target the members who have at least 2 years functional policing experience on the field. That's where we'll recruit members to put them in the public order police unit. And we can also target members who are at the station who have been involved in policing activities for at least 2 years. The curriculum. The Secretariat has spoken about that we need to review the curriculum. We agree. We agree, and we've already started in doing that to ensure that we look into the current curriculum and then we check whether does it address the concerns which we are having right now or not. So therefore, we have called upon the commanders and then we introduced them to the crowd management legislation, that's the Gathering Act. We've also prepared some of the crowd management incidents whereby we show them, visualize, we show them the pictures, we show them the videos of some of the incidents which have happened in MLO, some in Free State and so forth, to say that here we didn't do well. How can we solve this problem? We ensure that moving forward then we perform our duties better than previous. So we do all those things. Weapon handling and operational orders. As I've said, that we review the operational orders to ensure that members, they operate in the standardized way. All members who are involved in the crowd management units, they do that. Operational plan and layout. Planning, it was also mentioned. It is true. We have also focused much on planning. In the police language, you talk about this golden triangle, the Section 4 meeting. Our members, when they sit in that Section 4 meeting, we need members who are put up, the responsible member from the SAPS, who will sit there having the negotiation skills when they put the condition forward to say that when you are organizing a march, you need to have X number of marshals, and this is the route which you are going to use, and these are the kind of tools you are going to put on so that we can identify that these are the marshals. We need somebody who can articulate those things. Put all the risk on the table so that the convener or the organizer must understand. And again, we like to see the situation whereby the authorized member from the municipality side, the person who's authorizing these marches, he also understands or she also understands all the risks which will be tabled by this police officer. The crowd management techniques, I've already touched on that, but my colleagues have also touched on that. That's whereby we talk about the barriers which need to be put in place to try to separate the police and the protesters so that we avoid unnecessary contact, physical contact between the two, and it will alleviate all those unnecessary assault cases and so forth. And the platoon and the section formation, because in the crowd management environment, surely we need to operate as a formation. We don't want to see the situation which we have already seen in the country out there, whereby you find this lone police officer operating on his own, alone there, shooting with his pistol. We don't want to see those situations. In this environment, we must operate in the formation, either in the section, platoon, and so forth. And each and every section or platoon, it must have a commander. each and every action which the police officer in that particular formation must act on instruction or on command of the commander. This is what we want to bring about so that we alleviate all this problem. The briefing and debriefing, I cannot overemphasize it. My colleagues have already spoken about that. We've also seen that at times it is lacking. Because if you brief your members before you go and operate, surely you'll have different teams to say yourself you're going to make a barrier. This team will ensure that if there is a troublemaker within the crowd, if I say go and arrest, there will be certain people who will go and pick up that particular individual, take him away from the environment. So these are the things which we have identified and we want to deal with it. And this can be alleviated if there is a proper briefing. But we have traced this information to the commander that we want to see these things happening. And over and above that, after each and every operation, we demand a debriefing report. It was alluded by my colleague this side. It was also alluded by the secretary that the debriefing report, it needs to be compiled comprehensively so that it captures everything what happened there. So this debriefing report, it will assist us to improve on our operation. It will assist us to improve or to close the gaps which we identified during our operations. The next slide. These are the kind of training which all of us have spoken about it, that we need to ensure that this is being done. These training are for the command structure. The operational commander training, the OCG, will ensure that all our commanders, whoever will be commanding, whether it's a section or the platoon and so forth, must undergo this training. This training, among the others, it entails the planning. Once the commander went through this training, definitely you know how to plan and how to deal with this situation. And the platoon commander's training, my colleagues, I'm not sure, but my colleagues have also referred to, previously it was just a generic training, crowd management training for everybody. We didn't subject our commanders to various levels of training to ensure that they're equipped enough to can deal with their responsibilities. So we have also developed this platoon commander's training. We have also developed the section leader's training. Whether it's the sergeant who's commanding 3 or 5 or 6 members must undergo this training so that he or she must know what kind of instruction must he or she issue to the members and how to deal with all the situation. The 8,500 members which undergone the French model training prior to World Cup, these are the members who were taken from various host cities, from station levels and so forth. Among the others, these are the members whom we have prepared to can be the first responders. In case something happened before the public order units members they can respond, then these members, they must ensure that they respond to those eventualities. The challenges we are having is that these members, at times you find that there is a situation and these members, they are not on duty. It's something which you need to fix it internally to ensure that on the 24-hour basis, we do have a capacity in each and every shift of members who can be the first responders in case of a spontaneous march or protest or unplanned protest which is happening within that particular station area. Among the others, Madam Chair and Honourable Members, after realizing that things are falling apart, then we call the Public Order Police Conference. We call all the commanders. That's where now it was our turn to read the Riot Act for them. Tell them what we like, what we don't like seeing out there. And then we have also come up with the National Public Order Team as a pilot project. Call the members in, we train them, and then we kept them as a reserve team. We see whether this thing it can work perfectly for us. And it has worked perfectly for us, especially during the local government election. We had the national capacity, which was based in our mobilization center, whereby we deployed them over the country if things are falling apart. The use of force guidelines, we've also realized that this thing is getting out of hand. That's whereby we've involved our legal services to develop a guideline, and then we started educating our members about the use of force. the commander training, we have also ensured that these commanders, we subject them to the relevant training. We have also established a team nationally whereby we said they must go out there, led by General Mkhwanazi, to ensure that they go out there and meet with all the unit commanders and to evaluate whether the national instructions previously issued, the SOPs, the directives, which the members they are still operating on, whether they are current or not. My colleagues have also spoken about that there is a need to review all those things. Already the team is doing that, to look at those things. Legal services, they are also looking into our national intervention. Here we said the policy, but in reality, the national national instruction, which it was developed some years ago, to look into it and see whether what need to be changed there. It's also been dealt with. The workshop, there are currently workshops which are continuing. Among the others, there is one which is going on right now, whereby we look into the current curriculum of public order, whether it is recent, whether we need to improve on that. The Belgian model, which my colleague have spoken about, and the French model, we see what best practices can we pick up from the Belgian one, what best practices can we pick up from the French one, and put them together and see whether can't we have something which it will assist us moving forward. Currently, there is a team sitting at head office. They are doing that to review all the curriculum relevant to the public order. Again, we have embarked on training our members in terms of utilizing this 40-millimeter launcher. This is a non-lethal machine which we are using to deal with the crowd. We have already trained members in the Eastern Cape, Western Cape, Gauteng, KwaZulu-Natal, Northwest, and Limpopo. The remaining provinces will ensure that before the end of this year, before December, they should have undergone this training. Before we issue them with this machine, we ensure that they undergo training, how to utilize it. Because this thing, if you didn't undergo training, how to utilize this thing, you may end up shooting at somebody in the close range and costing this particular person's life. So somebody must undergo training, knows the angle, how to fire this thing, whether on the ground or on the air and so forth, but to ensure that it doesn't injure or cause fatalities to our people. The refresher program, we have realized that since all these changes and we have forgotten about the public order and to empower them about how to deal with the crowd management issues, we have again embarked on the refresher training. Already we started with the KwaZulu-Natal units to ensure that we prepare them for the COP17 climate change conference which is coming to our country November to December. We are already preparing them for that. Train the trainer course, we have also subjected our members for that so that these trainers, they must be members who are, what do they say with this nice English? Recognized by SAQA. There must be these people who are accredited by SAQA. So these members, we're subjecting them to that particular training. Addressing the command and control, as I've already alluded, we've realized that this is the problem and we're working hard on that so that we deal with that. Madam Chair, we have also felt that it is important to have this regular engagement with those people who are involved, the labor unions, your big federation, your consortium, your SATAU, the SALGA, the COGTA, this department. We felt that it is important for us to sit around the table on the ongoing basis to agree on the rules of engagement. Every time if there is a protest, whether people are protesting against service delivery or it's a labor dispute and so forth, at the end of the day, it ends up being the police problem. It is us against those people. The employer is no longer on the pitch. If it is the service delivery problem, the municipality is no longer on the pitch. Now it is the police versus the community out there. We want to agree on the rules of engagement. How are we going to move forward? And among the others, to ensure that in that Section 4 meeting, the Golden Triangle meeting, when we talk about the conditions which we need to put on place for the particular martial gathering, all of us, we commit ourselves that we are going to adhere to that. And we need to be clear on each other that failure to adhere to those conditions, what then? What are the consequences? If it is the convener, are we going to ensure that we register the case documents and what is going to happen? And how are we going to deal with this particular convener in future if he or she comes again and says, I'm sending a notice to have a march? And then we will be in the position to can show the history that previously you came, you applied, and this is what happened. What are you going to do differently that these things are not happening again? This is some of the things which we are going to engage with them. And again, try to build a very good relationship between us and all the stakeholders involved in this protest. We also want to ensure that we build capacity, we expand, reopen some of the public order units which were closed previously, so that we can improve the response to some of the areas which are far afield, and then the existing units, they cannot respond accordingly. Coming to the to recruitment and selection, what we need to do, Madam Chair, is to deal with the baseline physical fitness exercise. We ensure that we members who are in the POPs are members who are physically fit, to avoid the situation whereby you find there is a physical contact between the member of the striking community and the police officer. You find the police officer now has been embarrassed, thrown on the ground and so forth. And when he wakes up there, he's angry now, he starts to lose his mind and so forth. So we want to ensure that our members are physically prepared to ensure that they can deal with whatever eventually. And baseline practical shooting exercise, to ensure that they know how to shoot and so forth, and each and every firearm issued to them, they know how to utilize it. And also the distance, when can I use the rubber shot? They must be in the position to know those things. So these are the things which we want to work on that. Actually, we have already started to say that training, they must work on those things. Psychometric evaluation, as my colleague has said, we want to work hard on that to ensure that what kind of members are we recruiting in this environment. We don't want temperamental members who get easily angry, who get easily provoked. We don't want those kind of members. We need to have members who can try their level best to restrain themselves, because we regard ourselves as professionals. So we need to restrain ourselves. The future training, as I've said, that will embark on the refresher training for all corp members and the commanders. And then the refresher training, it will be a 5-day program whereby it is done on various units, so that we don't take members away from those environments and then we keep them for some time and we find that the provinces are suffering. This is the refresher training for those members who have undergone intensive crowd management training developed by the French and the Belgian. And for this financial year, Madam Chair, we have planned that we have 9 courses, of which each course will comprise of 80 members. And thus far, we have already trained, we have already done 5 courses. We are remaining with 4 courses. Okay, I'll run fast, Madam Chair. The recruitment, I'll skip it. I've already dealt with the recruitment. Let me jump straight to the challenges, Madam Chair. The prosecution, which I was talking about in terms of the how do we enforce the Regulation of Gathering Act, we do make arrests. We do take people to court. But prosecution, there's nothing which we can be proud of thus far. Reason being, amongst the others, it is difficult to obtain the witness statements from the very same crowd. So if we begin to utilize the video material, it will assist us to gather the relevant exhibit or information which can be presented to court. But that's why we arrest, but prosecution is not so good. That's the challenge which we are having. And again, to get the witness statement, it's a challenge. Again, it is a challenge to go to the authorized member of the local government to say, colleague, we have agreed during the Golden Triangle meeting to say that these are the conditions which the convener must adhere to. The convener didn't adhere to that. Press charges or give us a statement to say that you have issued this condition and these people that didn't adhere to that. No more cooperation from that side. So those things, they affect our conviction. The issue of the ongoing violent demonstration and service delivery, it is a challenge for us every day. Every day we know that we are busy with dealing with those challenges. Some are just spontaneous and so forth. As I've said, that at the end of the day, it remains the police problem, no longer those people versus whoever must provide service to the community. The role of local authority in planning, authorizing the protest and demonstration. Madam Chair, the challenge we're having is that a chance, even if we can try to protest from the police side to say, colleague, already in this city we have 5 planned marches. If you authorize the 5th one or the 6th one, we are going to have a challenge because we are going to be seen on the ground. They'll continue to issue that authorization. And a chance it compromises all the security measures which you need to put in. The lack of general knowledge with regard to the rights and the limitation, Madam Chair, you spoke very clearly about that. It is true, people, they only concentrate on their right to protest and so forth. As to there is limitation that there are other people out there who doesn't want to participate, they don't recognize it. They'll force people into the march and so forth, and of which it becomes a problem. And again, when we condemn, we don't have any problem when the civil society condemn us about the manner in which we have dealt with the situation. But we wish that one day, let the Human Rights Commission also condemn the conveners, the people who are organizing this march, and say, hey, you municipal workers, you have been granted the permission to march, but look what you are doing. What you are doing is not in line with the Constitution. But what happens is that they only condemn the police. This other part is not being condemned. Or if it is condemned, we don't feel that they are condemned adequately in the manner in which we have also been condemned. The provocation and incitement in the violence, it does happen all over the show, and this is the problem. It forces the police officers to end up upholding the law, which our constitution demands that we need to do. At times it may be a peaceful march, but you find that among the marchers, somebody is now provoking the others to do certain things, to throw stones and whatever. It forces the police now to escalate and the intervention which we are applying at that point in time. The last one, which is critical, Madam Chair, is that the lack of feedback and response by the people, the institution and the departments which are receiving the memorandum. You find that people, they come, they want to hand over the memorandum, there's nobody to receive the memorandum. As a result, the police must receive the memorandum on the behalf. After receiving this memorandum from the police, they don't respond to those people. This is a challenge. For example, in Freestyle, that one of the Tatar, it was the 3rd memorandum submitted to the various municipalities. What happened to the 1st one? What happened to the 2nd one? Nobody worried about that. And as a result, it makes the community to be agitated. Thank you, Madam Chair.
Madam Chair, honorable members, let me conclude the presentation of the South African Police Service.
Yes, thank you very much, General Libeya. You are General Mawela. Well, thank you very much for the presentation as well. I want to take questions, Honorable Annelies, Honorable Kalabanat, Honorable Ramatakane, Honorable Swate, Honorable Angie, Honorable Lekgetho, Honorable We are going to take a real 5 minutes break. 5 minutes. And then we'll come back here. When we sit, the first person to ask questions or member to ask questions will ask the question, the first question. 5 minutes.
Is it all right? And then just
Thank you, members. I think we have got to proceed, but maybe let me just make this comment that maybe as we are sitting here, there is indeed a demonstration or a protest march that is taking place in Johannesburg, in Odea Square. And discussing these matters, I think it is important for us to make a call to all those that are participating in that demonstration, that good as it is a constitutional right to do so, but the Constitution is very clear. It actually says that it is a right to be involved in a peaceful and unarmed assembly or demonstration. And that definitely excludes throwing of stones. It exclude anything untoward. And I think it is important that as we enjoy and exercise this right, we keep to ourselves the fact that this right is very specific. It says unarmed and peaceful demonstration, and nothing more and nothing less. I'm just really making a call to anybody who is at this time participating in any demonstration, including the members of the ANC Youth League in Gauteng. Let me take the first question, Honourable Member.
Thank you, Chairperson. Yes, I believe there's already been skirmishes between the police and the demonstrators. And one would be interested in knowing, you know, in terms of planning, how one would go about the day, a day like today as well. And I want to add my voice to what the Chairperson has said in condemning any form of misbehavior, faggish behavior, in any protest action or demonstration of any kind. And I think that is something that we need to address as organizations, but also as unions, on how do our members behave, take responsibility for the behavior. So my first question would be to the police. Without interfering with the court case itself, but can the police indicate to us what lessons they have learned from the Tathame case? What are they doing differently as a result of what was a horrible scene to see, and reminded us about protests in the 80s and the way it was dealt with in the 80s. So can SAPSC indicate to us what lessons have they learned, what are they doing differently? In terms of the Secretariat, Jay, there is something that I would like to ask the Secretariat, and maybe the police should answer to this as well. I'm a bit confused about what the Secretariat said versus what the police are saying. The Secretariat clearly indicated a preference, if I understand correctly, for the French model. Yet the police are talking about the Belgian model. So we need to get a clarity on this. And as far as I understand, the Secretariat is responsible for policy, SAPS is responsible for the implementation thereof. And I mean, I just think it's a bit problematic when we hear SAPS talking about Belgium, French, but also the Belgium, and you sort of lean towards the Belgium part of it. I would also ask the Secretariat just to explain to us the difference between the two, the main differences between the two. A week ago, 2 weeks ago, we had the Samu protests, and they were also coming to Parliament. And I found it quite interesting the morning when I came into Parliament to see the POP unit coming from, I think, the Boer lot, if I'm not mistaken, coming from there, standing at the gates, protecting Parliament as institution of democracy. And they were well equipped, fully equipped. But next to them, right next to them, was standing the ordinary police officer who normally guards the gates at Parliament and is responsible for the protection of Parliament, without a bulletproof vest. And that's, on that day, we had a look at more than one of them that were actually without bulletproof vests, standing right next to this person who's coming from the POP unit. And to me, it speaks to what is not happening on the ground. The generals speak about coordination between the unit and the local station. I would say in this case, then the unit and the VIP unit at Parliament taking the place of the station, but yet we don't see that interaction taking place on the ground. I think also the ICD's report referred to the fact that they don't believe there's enough communication between the two. Why do we still see that if you say that these are the things that you have improved? ICD, I'm worried about one figure that you gave us, two in fact. The one is the KZN figure, 15 deaths, but only 22 incidents. So I figure of deaths, is there, could you in your investigations came across, that you come across any specific reasons why in KwaZulu-Natal it is this high? And are there any specific recommendations in that regard? The other question to the ICD chairperson is, why do we have a situation, what are the reasons that you have sent 52% of your cases through for prosecution, but yet only four actual prosecutions take place? That you speak to the prosecutors to find out why they are denying to prosecute in the other cases. What are the problems? Chair, I would like to just last questions to the police. Suggestion first. I know that there's a program in SAPS currently to test all firearms ballistically, but I would suggest that the place to start would be at the POP units, and that all firearms at POP units be ballistically tested, so that we have that on the record, so that when one needs to investigate an unfortunate situation, have that avenue to pursue. And what is about the statement that was made by the General about equipment not maintained? Why in life would we not maintain equipment? What type of equipment are we talking about that have not been maintained? And what is the state of those equipment currently? What is it going to cost us to replace that equipment? Chair, I'm also interested to find out not, and I think other members of the committee might be in the same position, even as the figures for National Head Office, 100, of equipment being available, is not giving us a clear picture. It's not indicating to us what is the state of the equipment at the unit on the ground. How many helmets do we have? How many do we need? I'm asking this question specifically, Jay, because you would remember when we were at the training college in KZN that we came across SAPS at that stage in a room, a huge room, busy distributing the helmets and the stuff that was bought for the Soccer World Cup. The only problem is this was done after the Soccer World Cup.
Yeah.
This distribution was done after the Soccer World Cup. So we're very interested in where are those equipment. Are they used, those equipment that was bought specifically for the Soccer World Cup, where are those equipment? Because that's one of the criticisms we have, let me speak for myself, that I have in terms of the policing of demonstrations and protests, is that we don't see SAPS members in those equipment and using those equipment, including the water cannons. Last question, Chair. How many commanders do we have currently? POP commanders. How many of them have been trained, have undergone the OCT training, and how many of them still need to do the OCT training? How long is it going to take for them to do that training? Chair, just a last comment from my side. I was struck by the absence in such presentation of the role of intelligence. Never once did they refer to the role of intelligence. Yet it was something that came up in the policy, it was something that even came up in the ICD's presentation, and I agree. Policing in general should be based on intelligence. We should talk about intelligence-driven policing. Now, you can't go into a situation where you're going to do public order policing and you have not gathered intelligence. You do not know who are the hooligans that might get involved in the strike, even if they're not part of the strike. Can SAPS explain to us the absence of the role of crime intelligence in this? Thank you, Chair.
Thank you, Chair. What I'd like to know is why it is that why are we sitting here right now with reports pouring in about a very violent demonstration underway by the ANC Youth League, water cannons, rubber bullets, missiles being thrown. Now, as far as I know, it was an illegal gathering, and you knew it was going to happen. Where indeed was the intelligence? Why was it allowed to proceed? And are you somehow taking a back foot stand because it's the ANC Youth League? I don't understand. Why would this be allowed when you had so much warning that in fact you've ended up in a terrible situation where people actually may be injured and you could have prevented this? So we're sitting here discussing this right now while it's happening. I find that absolutely extraordinary. We've seen about 3 days of riots in two cities in the UK, and the outcome was that the rioting eventually was stopped, there were minimal injuries, and there were thousands upon thousands of arrests. The court stayed open that following weekend to deal with all of those people, and they were literally tried, done, jailed, over and done with. And yet, we see in this country, and I'm looking at your figures, over 11,500 protests in a year. And I've crunched the numbers. I've sat here doing it. On average, you arrest 3 people during one of these violent protests. I find that extraordinary. I mean, it's as though you don't feel you have the right to prevent people from smashing windscreens, smashing shop fronts, setting things on fire. You do, because that's actually your job. And it's inexplicable why it's happening that you allow it to happen. The man in the street doesn't actually have the confidence in the SAPs when they come to these violent protests, these violent actions, these violent demonstrations, because no one's ever arrested. We had the private security demonstrations. People were thrown off of trains and murdered. And to my knowledge, not a single soul was arrested. And I think that we need some explanations here today. There were 13,282 gatherings and 43,000 people arrested. Some not violent gatherings, some out, but the average of 3 that you do arrest. I'd like to know if you're putting these names on a database like they did for the FIFA World Cup, where they had a database of known hooligans around the world. Are we building up our own database of hooligans at these protests? Is it not that they're being led by a small coterie of people who go around running them, literally orchestrating these protests, which are becoming increasingly violent, as you just told us? And to the ICD, they're in 8% of the 204 cases that led to recommendations being made to the police in terms of their members becoming increasingly violent or violent GBH cases. And in the light of the fact that the vast majority, I think we were up to 80% last time I got a response from the ministry or from yourselves, the vast majority of ICD recommendations are ignored by the SAPs. So of this 8% of the recommendations, I'd like to know how many of them were implemented by the SAPs. I'll be most interested to hear that, because we've seen, as we've done station visits, where you see something that is absolutely judged by the ICD to have been criminal, and those 3 men stamped, rubber stamped, not guilty, no, we don't like what they have to say, we'll just pass our own judgment. It doesn't reflect well. And the ICD has given a most obvious recommendation. The police procedure crowd management equipment that can be linked to a specific user. I think that's an excellent recommendation, and I was actually surprised to see that it is a recommendation, because I would have thought that SAPS already did that, and I'd like an assurance that you actually do, because you would immediately be able to link an individual to an action. This person was using this firearm, we have it logged, we have it recorded, it shot another individual. And that would make the investigations, not only by yourselves, but also by the ICD, so much easier. So if it is a recommendation, it's telling me that actually you're not doing that, which I find quite extraordinary. It's very difficult to pinpoint people in that crowd-type situation. Thank you.
Thank you, Honorable Chair. I just want to ask it's a linked question, but it's mainly with the police. They spoke in a slide number 5 around the trends from 1995 around the issue of POPs, changing of names and changing of names to POT. Now, I just want to understand this. Is that a contention from SERPs that the changes of name of those who are already in the police has any negative effect in terms of doing the work that is supposed to do? You mentioned, make a statement, when we realize that things are falling apart, we had to jump in. Now, I'm quite confused about that particular statement, because my contention is that those who have been trained to be POPs that were doing that were policy-wise clustered into provinces while they still remain a national unit, but clustered in the provinces with the capacity they have, with a continuous capacity. Now, I don't understand your statement. Therefore, I just want you to explain that statement. Because if you look at where is the area combating unit, which always had the red badge along, and they were allocated as such, are you arguing here that changing of name has had that negative effect? Because that's more or less what I'm hearing you arguing, the point that you're arguing. I'm taken aback by the slides here, that 25 that was presented by the ICD. It makes the recommendation, it captures certain function as challenges. In my view, there are no challenges. The basic function that has to be done by the police. That's why you have orders. That's why you have police order this, police order that, police order that. Why should it be kept as a challenge, and the ICD must be the one that informs the police about their normal policing function that has to happen? I'm quite taken aback by that. I don't understand it. Is it that argument that the police are presenting, that those who are commanders, and I guess they have probably average of 10, 20 years in the police and plus, that are in the police in terms of management, including the crowd management, that they don't suddenly, in 2011, they need to be trained around the basic police orders. The simple police order, SMP order 15, is that the argument that has been presented here? I thought it is a normal, basic police function that has to happen on a daily basis in order to know what has happened. The third thing that is related to this, a question which I do want to understand, it comes from the policy perspective, but it's creating policy. In fact, I think it's linked to Belgium and France issue that has been talked about. Is the suggestions that is presented forward-looking in terms of changing of policing model? Because currently you have what is called, referred to as cluster. Everything is clustered. Police are clustered into a particular zone with a particular capacity brought into that. And is it a change of policy perspective in terms of coming? Because I had a station capacity, whilst at the moment what we have is the area capacity. We're clustered with those, whether you call them POPs, or you call them ACC unit or CCU unit, clustered in that particular area for quick response. Now, I don't understand what is a change of policy, because if it is a change of policy, then the resource issues that goes with the change of policy in terms of the current is another challenge that you're going to have to cross in terms of, I think the policy will then have to deal with that question. And let me end, Chair, by saying that I am shocked to hear this. The general says we don't get the reason why we have not sufficient conviction rate with respect to the protest breach of conditions is because we don't have information. We don't have conditions that have been breached. My understanding is that the lead agency in terms of this will always be the police. Now, in the triangle or the four section four meeting, police and the commander is there. The conditions are concretized, are agreed, and everybody that leaves there got conditions of the march. In the case of the breach, the lead agency has to respond and correct the breach. Now, how can you, the police says, we are unable to convict because we don't have the conditions that were supposed to be complied with when they are at the center to the enforcement and central to the policing of that particular activity? I mean, the issue about that has been raised now about pelleting the police with stones in Gauteng, it's fall probably in the realm of unplanned, but it's not quite unplanned. Police cordon off the streets there. They prepare for this eventuality, which means they knew about it. But what has been the plan to prevent? Because if you cordon off the area of something that has not been planned, that has not been applied for, who is going to be the organizer in terms of the act that must be held responsible? Certainly, in that you will arrest, you don't add, you don't have anything to impose because nobody has breached any conditions. But you need to plan for it. You help to plan for that particular illegal activity. So these are the concerns I'm raising. Others are really questions that the police can respond to. I really don't have questions about the ICD other than the issue that has been raised already, but I think mainly it's a policy question as well as a police question. Thanks, Chair.
Thank you, Bill.
My question is on the TRT unit. We have seen and we know that this unit commits a lot of violence and atrocities. And now, to my surprise, I see from the presentation, I see only 13 cases. Is this the real picture of the activities of the TRT unit? Is it really the real picture? My other question was also on the unplanned gatherings. Why are they allowed to go on if they are unplanned? Why are they allowed? My other question is on the isolation of key individuals. How will this be done? Will people apply and they maybe turned down to say, no, you cannot be part of this? Or how will it be done? Because in my experience, a march is a march. Anybody goes. Whether what, they just join the march. So what I want to know is, how will it be done? Thanks, Chair.
Thank you very much, Chairperson, and thank you very much for the presenters. I've got several questions to ask. And my first question is with regard to the information that we received pertaining to the World Cup, the preparations. It was indicated that you used French system or method to combat the problems dealing with crowd controlling. But the SAPS changed eventually to Belgium model, as it was indicated. So I just want to know, why did you change from the model that was working to a model that seems not working? And what made actually subs to change? Maybe there are some circumstances that forced you to change from that model to Belgium one. And my second one is with regard to the slide 12, indicating that you indicated that you, in terms of the equipment and the resources, you didn't actually, in most of the marches or the protests, you didn't have actually video cameras. At slide 12, at the bottom there, you indicated there was no video cameras. So that you can't capture what actually happened. But whilst you said that, when you were actually expatiating on that, you also indicated that you had some information where you had to sit down to look what happened in those in the incidents, whereas you indicated that you didn't have an equipment to actually capture what was happening. So my question is, where did you get that information if you didn't have the video camera in terms of what you have reported on slide number 12? And with regard to slide 18, crowd management, and you also indicated in terms of crowd management curriculum, you also indicated that you also had you were reviewing some of the things that actually were happening, the mistakes, so in order to improve what was actually happening when some people were involved in a protest march or in a strike. And you actually wanted to win that battle, but it seems you are not actually winning the battle, as you are indicating that there are some problems that are actually related to that. And my question is now coming in the fray that if you have actually seen what actually has happened, why didn't you come up with a mechanism to stop such incidents in the coming or in the protest that happened thereafter? And slide number 19, you also indicated the debriefing and the briefing information, which you put it as something that you're still going to do. But according to my understanding, that before there is a march, a planned or unplanned, I think this should have been the base of actually putting resources and actually preparing yourself so that when the protests do happen, you actually know that who's going to do what at what time, with what equipment. But you indicating here that you're still putting that as what you are going to do in future. So my question is now, if that is the case, it seems every time you are not ready as such. So my question is, why are you not prepared? Because you are actually securing the country. And so that's actually what actually amazes me. And my last one is with regard to the negotiations. You also indicated that when there are strikes or service delivery protests, only police are being blamed and not the union or the employers or the service providers. Only police are being blamed, and you, and also the people who are actually causing problems are also the organizers of the marches are not also being blamed. But this now raises a very serious issue with regard to the protection of innocent people and property, because I believe as the responsibility, even if it is a march or not a march, people must be protected. The innocent people must be protected, and also property must be protected, and that's the responsibility of police. So I should think that maybe we need thorough explanation in that regard, because if that is the blame must not be on police only. I think crime is crime wherever it happens. Police must act on that one. So I need thorough explanation. Are we saying that if maybe we are saying that even if we strike, those people who are actually doing are leading the matches, if there are some things that are actually happening, are you saying police must just not doing anything, and so that we can blame the organizers of the match? But I believe, Chairperson, that police should actually come clear on that one, so that we can understand exactly what is actually happening. And my last one is with regard to the ICD. In terms of the cases, you also said you received 204 cases and 85 were investigated and completed. 79 of the 204 cases received were already closed. Of the 79 cases, 4 cases resulted in prosecution, of which 2 cases resulted in acquittals, 1 case in inquest and case in conviction. And you also indicated 75 were closed because of unsubstantiated, as members could not be identified. So I'm very much actually concerned with this because it shows that maybe there is a serious gap that is actually happening in actually investigating cases. Thank you very much.
Thank you. Thank you, Chair. Let me also thank for presentations. I am talking from an experience that when you go on a constitutional march, you must follow procedures and get approval. But there were one instance where I come from in Mafeking, where the police in particular refused the community permission to march. There were marches that I have witnessed that were peaceful, led by the police. They were very, very, very peaceful. So all what I'm saying here is that the police play a very important role in ensuring that the constitutional marches are very peaceful by leading and calling off at a distance or refusing the community's marches. That must be investigated, why these marches become ultimately violent. The second thing is on I'm happy that you have identified that you've got 330 vacant posts. That is very, very good to inform us about that, but you don't tell us when exactly are you going to fill these vacant posts, because unemployment is a bit high and the government has committed itself having unemployment by 2040. I am not sure that you have made us aware that you use a lethal force when you don't have rubber bullets. And I think also because marches very often are emotional and become confrontational, that when are you getting rubber bullets so that you don't replace rubber bullets by lethal force. Last feature, yes, I'm very happy also that you learn from other nations like France during the FIFA World Cup, and that is very, very good. I think you must learn more. Don't learn now and leave everything and forget. You are talking about the establishment of a dedicated POP unit. You don't tell us when will this happen. Do you have time frames? Because if you say dedicated and then you don't come with time frames to me, it becomes a very sweeping statement.
please, if you can just indicate. Thank you, Chair.
Thanks, Jefferson, and let me thank all the presenters. I think some of my questions have been covered, but I'll try and repeat them, some of them. The one that seemed to have sparked a lot of interest among members is the one of the French model versus the Belgian model. As the presenter from the secretariat was presenting and came up to this one, I was asking myself, but this model is hardly, it's only a year old. And I believe that that you never woke up and say we're going to implement this, we're going to take this model. A thorough research was done before you could then settle for this model. Why then, hardly a year then, the model was then abandoned? The flaws, the gaps, the shortcomings that were identified so quickly. And the other one was a presentation by the ICD with regard, that is on slide 17. Stats of cases of problems. These stats date back to 9 years ago. If my calculation is correct. Out of 204 cases, you still have 39 cases that are active. What I would like to find out, how old are these cases? Do we still, out of these 39, do we still have cases that date back to 2002? Because these stats are from that date. If yes, when will these cases be completed, and why are they still active? The last question was the presentation by the SAPS that was on slide or page 11. I think it's slide 11. Resources and vehicles. You did indicate that the number of vehicles, the AMA vehicles, the LGVs, whatsoever, the number that you have. What I would like to know is the distribution or breakdown of these resources or of these equipments as per province, the 9 provinces that we have, not even stations. Because it would be a futile report to tell us about them here, whereas we find that they are nowhere, they are somewhere, they are not where they are supposed to be. And the other one was with regard to the incidents that were being videoed at some point, and suddenly that exercise stopped. And it was fine, it was normally stopped. We are not given reason why it was suddenly stopped, and what did the department do with regard to that? So I'd like to find out what did it do, or it was just fine, they don't have get that, so it's thank you, Dr. Okay, thanks, Chaplain.
Yeah, thank you very much, members. I think I have just a few questions, because most of the questions have already been asked. But maybe to the Secretariat, you have presented the policy. The question I have is, what are the budget implications and what are the time frames in the implementation of some of the things that you have raised here? When can we expect that? When is a matter of fact? Maybe one other worry I have, I'm not sure whether it is is proper to have it, but if they said that, I didn't hear anyone of you referring or even mentioning the Safety at Sports and Recreational Events mm-hmm. Act. Mm-hmm. And it is worrying me mm-hmm. because probably it could be that you're not aware that there is such an act, and it is a very recent act. I think it is just passed last year, and it talks to some of the issues that are being raised here. Maybe going to ICT. ICT. But maybe the questions will also apply to that. Page 11 or slide 11. We have Mpumalanga. Oh, okay, maybe KwaZulu-Natal and Honorable Annelies has raised this one about cases in Mpumalanga. 77 cases. 60 GBH. 12 murder. Going to slide number 50. Public order police and station members, Mpumalanga will be 36. TRT members in Mpumalanga only 13. Pop intervention unit and TRT in Mpumalanga only 77. I mean 27. Organized crime unit in Mpumalanga only 1. I just really want to know as to what do you think is happening in Mpumalanga, and what is the department as well as ICD doing? Because I would have thought that TRT is a specialized unit. And if TRT, I don't know whether it is properly used or abused or misused in this manner, what is the department doing about it? And as a matter of fact, I can tell you that even these figures that are here are not reflecting of what TRT is doing on the ground. It's nothing compared to what TRT is doing on the ground. If you go to Carolina Slobela Township today and go to any house, any, they will tell you that I was sitting in my house with my family, we were drinking some whatever, and they came and beat us. And I don't know as to what is the department doing in this regard, because this actually is talking to a serious abuse of a specialized unit. As by ourselves as politicians, or you are therefore not in control of the situation. I'm just asking you. These active cases, the question to ICD is, for how long have they been active? Because we're talking about 2002 to 2011. For how long have these cases been active? I'm also worried about the low conviction and the effect it will have to people who participate in this criminal act and violent protests, and knowing that nothing is going to happen to them, because the conviction is such that nothing will happen to them. And also, I think the member of SAPS, when he made his presentation, it was like, in each protest, where and when there's criminality, arrest is made. I can tell you, say it's not true. Go to Pit Retief today in Mpumalanga. The clinic was burnt down. Community hall. I think 4 houses of councillors. Nobody, I mean not, was ever arrested. Not. Nobody was ever arrested. Up until today, nobody has been arrested. Nobody. I mean nobody. It's not like people are not know. It's not like communities are not willing to give information. But it's not like there isn't intelligence in SAPS, because we think there's crime intelligence in SAPS. but nobody, as we speak, has been arrested in that area. Next, going to the sub-presentation, which I found to be very interesting, is the fact that as you were making the presentations of changes that occurred and probably the positive impact, negative impact those changes have had, I want to know as to whether you are saying to date the POP, its primary focus is crime prevention and crowd control, that is the POP is crowd management. What does this mean in terms of budget, in terms of equipment, in terms of training, in terms of everything, in terms of priority, what is this supposed to mean? I really want to know, and what is the impact of this? That the standardization of procedures in such to manage crime. You know, can I really ask, how are you going to ensure and evaluate that your members know? And I'm asking this question because ask any member of SAPS about your national instructions on anything they do not know, the police station level. Ask them about your DVA national instructions, your Child Justice Act, anything. They are national instructions. Sometimes they are even station instructions. They do not know. How are you going to ensure that these procedures are known to members sitting ahead of you? I'm really asking. You have said you are reviewing your curriculum, which I appreciate. But say, I can't understand. You know the curriculum that is being implemented this year is being implemented for the first time, if I'm not wrong, the basic curriculum. It was reviewed, and you, during the process of reviewal, you extended the duration of training to 2 years. If you're talking about the basic curriculum and curriculum, to say you want this to go into that so that any other member who completes training has an understanding of these issues, then of course they will specialize. I thought you were saying that. And if that is what you said, are you going to review a curriculum that is being implemented for the first time? And if that is what you're going to do, what does it mean with the processes of your reviewer? What is it that you're going to do better now? Because as a matter of fact, I'm asking this question because when we visited SAPS Academy, those trainers there were saying they were not involved in the reviewal of the curriculum. And for me, I don't understand as to how do you review a curriculum without involving people who were part of the implementation of the curriculum. So I just really want to know as to what exactly do you mean here. Maybe lastly, I think this question goes to both the secretariat and the department. Who makes policies in the department of OFSA? I'm asking then who is responsible for the implementation of policies. I'm asking this question because I was listening carefully to your presentation. Good as some of the things that you're raising are common to all your presentations, but they do not give us this picture that we know for a fact that as SAPS we are expecting a policy from this one and we are to implement, and therefore we know exactly that the policy says 1, 2, 3. It's like SAPS is planning its own thing. That is why you have your France, your French, and your Belgium, and the secretariat, as a matter of fact, the minister is also doing something else. I'm asking that question because, really, we contest elections. And when we contest elections, each party will say, this is my manifesto. This is what I'm going to do if I win elections. And it is that which will inform the policy. Now, it becomes a problem when departments develop policies, because what is informing them if it is not politicians who contest elections? I'm really asking this question so that maybe when we leave this room, we have the same understanding as to who is responsible for what. And when presentations in a forum such as this are made, we get this picture that there is an understanding as to who does what and who does what. Thank you very much. Can we allow you to respond? We'll start with IC.
Yes, would you allow me just one question in terms of clarity?
On page 10 of SAF's presentation, the approved 5,661, actual 4,343, and then you said to us that there's 330 vacant. What about the other 1,000 plus? Of ATRT.
Can I just start with the chair's last question on policy? I think that we adhere to the constitution, and the constitution is what determines how we should be operating, and I think the constitution is very clear. Policy is determined by the minister. I think it is abundantly clear, and I think that in the past there may have been a slipping away from that position, but I think it's been very clear with this minister that he is the person that determines policy, and the civilian secretariat for police prepares policy on his behalf, but it is the minister. So that's why I said at the beginning we had gone through a long policy process, we had come up with this document, it has been approved by the minister. It would be SAPS's role now to actually work out the implementation plans, etc., around that policy, and that is something that we will be expecting with the policy that is being developed and approved by the minister. Once approved, we would expect from SAPS a proper implementation plan of how they're going to implement that, and we will then monitor that implementation plan to make sure it is. But I think the constitution is very clear, so I think it's something which in the past may have been allowed to be blurred, but it's something certainly which is very clear. I think even in the Civilian Secretariat for Police Act, which has been signed off by the President, we refer to that. The White Paper refers to it, the Constitution refers to it, and I think it's something that we are constantly asserting within the Department, that it's the Minister who makes policy. We are there to assist him in providing the policy documents for the minister's approval, but it's him. It's neither the SAPS nor the secretariat. The secretariat's role is to prepare policy for the minister, but it's the minister who approves that policy, and once approved, it has to be implemented. So that's why at the beginning I said that we had prepared the policy document, and it has been approved by the minister. It is very recent that he has approved the policy. I mean, it's in the last week that he approved this policy, so it would also be understandable that it has not yet been communicated to SAPS. But we would be expecting a proper implementation plan. Just to answer the question about timeframes and costs, certain of the policy documents, there may be like the re-establishment of the POPs unit. We recognise that when we were drafting this, we recognised there would be costs. However, that actually speaks to what they should be anyway. The Act is very clear. It must be a national unit. And just to answer what's the difference between the national and the area unit and the name, I think what we're not saying here is that it mustn't have provincial and area capacity, but it must be part of a national structure. So you can't have a situation where your provincial commissioner or your provincial structure in that area or your cluster commander in that area decides that, you know what, we're going to deploy these POP unit people to do something else. We're going to deploy them to go and staff roadblocks, and then the local station lands up having to respond to a crowd a crowd gathering or whatever. So I think we're not saying it mustn't have area or provincial capacity, but it must be part of a national unit with a national line of command and control. And its primary function must be crowd control. its secondary function, if you look at the slide here from FATS, and it's something that we picked up, and I think we're in full agreement, ourselves and FATS, on this issue, although once the minister makes policy, it doesn't matter whether we're in agreement or not, it's policy, is that its primary function shouldn't be crime prevention, and its secondary function, crowd control. It should be crowd control with the secondary function, crime prevention. In fact, one of the things we point out in the policy document is that even certain functions of crime prevention which may lend itself particularly to the skills of the POP unit, coordinate search operations, etc., where the POP unit may be helpful. But its primary function must be crowd control, and it must be under a national command and control structure, not at the discretion of the provinces, whether, because, I mean, I think the general pointed out in his presentation that even the question of what equipment gets prioritized for the POP unit it shows where their priorities are. That it's not a question of prioritizing that POP units are sufficiently equipped with helmets, shields, etc., etc. Instead, what happens is they emphasize more the crime prevention equipment. So when they do have to do crowd control work, they don't necessarily have the equipment. So I think but we're not saying that it mustn't have a provincial and area capacity or cluster capacity, but we are saying it must be a national unit with a very clear mandate and set of instructions that also speaks to the issue of command and control. In terms of the questions that I think have, it wasn't really a question, it was more comments, but I think that were raised by the Chair and Honourable Member Van Wyk, and then I think it was also raised at a late point by Honourable Member Kola Barnard. I think that one of the things that we have got in the policy document is that Section 11 and 12 of the Regulation of Gatherings Act is very specific on being able to criminally prosecute and civilly charge conveners of gatherings. And that hasn't been happening. Mm-hmm. Conveners have been able to get away. There are very strict responsibilities on conveners. If there is a protest planned, which has been approved, protest march, and the crowd, something goes wrong in the crowd, and the conveners cannot control that crowd, they can be criminally prosecuted, and they can be also held civilly liable. And it's one of the things we say in the policy document is that this must be implemented. We must make use of Section 11 and Section 12 of the Regulation of Gatherings Act. Because, you know, very often it's hawkers, etc., on the side of the road who suffer as a result because people loot the hawkers, etc. So we are very clear that there must be proper prosecution and of such incidents. I mean, look, planned and unplanned marches happen all over the world. And when we were doing this research, it's not always planned marches that take place. Unplanned marches also happen throughout the world, and they're not always stopped because it may be better in terms of management of the situation to allow a march to go ahead. But one of the things that we do need to look at, how do we begin to prevent whatever gathering it is from becoming violent? And there are a number of tactics that we have looked at in terms, which are in the policy document in terms of international best practice, etc., around that. For example, one of the things that intelligence shouldn't just be about when the march is planned, how it's planned, etc., etc. Often there are pre-meetings before that march where things are discussed at that pre-meeting. We're going to go and burn down this councillor's house. We're going to go and do this. Where is the intelligence then to actually know that they're going to be going to a councillor's house to burn that councillor's house? Also, internationally, they make use of intelligence people in the crowd, and they will identify troublemakers in that crowd. So they may, in a march, identify a small group of people that they know by their movement in the crowd that this crowd, this group of people, are going to be causing trouble. What they will then do is they won't move in and just start shambocking or firing rubber bullets. They will begin to isolate those people from the rest of the crowd, and then they will do what they call snatch operations, where they snatch them. And they know, they're now slightly isolated from the crowd, so they're not being pulled out of the crowd where everybody around them. There are a number of those kinds of tactics which we have said we've got to start looking at. They are part of international best practices. In terms of the preference of the French and the Belgian model, I just want to say that what we're not proposing in the policy document is a one-size-fits-all model. They are different. We've gone in our policy document, we look at a number of different countries, Canada, Australia, UK, French. We look at some of the African countries, Botswana, Senegal, Ghana, etc., lessons from and what they're looking at doing. When we refer to the French and the Belgian model, it's a particular it's around a particular type of policing. And yes, we are supporting the French model. I think it's not as if SACs have kind of like gone the French model and then suddenly changed to the Belgian model. I think that's not what happened. What happened was that SACs have historically often used the Belgian model as a reference point. During the FIFA World Cup, they started to receive training from the French, and that began to influence their model. But what we're saying is that their thinking is still too much in the Belgian model. And one of our concerns around the Belgian model is that the French, we think, have a better approach to how to manage the relationship between the police and the crowd, where there's a distance issue. That if you have the further distance you are away from the crowd, the less you're able to manage that crowd. The closer you are to that crowd, the more able you are to manage it, and the less likely you are to then actually resort to shooting. And that's what we talk about in terms of the French and the Belgian model. But we're not saying that that the entire policy is based on the French model. It's a particular aspect of the of training and the relationship between the crowd and the police, where we refer to the French and Belgian model. The Belgian model is, I think, a more problematic, from our perspective, a more problematic model. But even within that model, there may be one or two good aspects. But essentially, we are proposing the French model, and since the minister has signed off on it, it will become policy. But it isn't as if our whole approach to crowd management is based purely on one model. As I said, we looked at Canada, Australia, UK, Ghana, Senegal, etc., as part of that model. In terms of the issue of the, I think I've addressed the issue of that we're not talking about a national unit that's situated at national head office and doesn't have provincial and cluster capacity, but we're talking about the emphasis of that. I think a lot's been said about the Section 4 hearing, and I think one of the things that we are saying in the policy document is who attends those Section 4 hearings, and the conditions that they place on the conveners of marches at those hearings is also crucial, because very often it's a bureaucratic process where maybe the station commission attends. Sometimes you don't even have a SACS official there. It may just be a local government person who phones a SACS person on the line. We're saying that if you establish a very strong public order policing, they must be the people that attend those gatherings, that they must be able to know what are the best routes, how they're going to manage different situations. In terms of I think I have to address the phrase. In terms of the timelines and the financial, I think I've spoken a bit about the financial. A lot of the issues that we are raising here, some of them around the equipment. We believe that there was equipment purchased during the World Cup, but they will have financial implications. The re-establishment of the POP unit may have some financial implications, but it is a requirement in terms of the Act. What we are now going to be doing, as I said, the Minister only approved this policy during the last week. What we are now going to be doing is sitting down with SACS around the implementation and expecting a proper implementation plan with timeframes so that we are able to monitor that, and we will provide the Portfolio Committee, and I'm sure SACS will also provide the Portfolio Committee with a copy of that. In terms of the issue of safety at sports and recreational events, it is mentioned in the policy document, but it's not highlighted quite as much as the Regulation of Gatherings Acts, etc., is, because our focus was really on the public protests and gatherings, because the policy focuses a lot more on that. It refers to events, but the focus is a lot more on gatherings and issues like that. I'm not sure if there's anything else to have.
Thank you very much, Chairperson. Maybe the first question raised by the Chairperson in relation to, and I think Mr. Marty also referred to that, in terms of the conviction rate of those cases referred. I think the experience that the Chairperson had in those specific areas is in line with the reports from our investigators. In terms of Mpumalanga, what we have did, especially after the Armaloa case, is we have strengthened our management in the province. We've also appointed a special task team to look at some of these cases. And there's also a team of four investigators that are currently also additionally deployed there to look at the cases. But the big issue is, and I think maybe the other colleagues can also speak to the issue of why the DPP don't prosecute. It's got to do with the ability of us to identify witnesses that place those suspects on the scene. In most of the cases, the statements from the victims is in line with what the chairperson indicated, and it's in line with that. But our biggest problem is the question of identification, and that's why we made the recommendation that in future it's important that there should be specific identification marks as well as numbers to ensure that we are able to identify the members. In terms of the 8% recommendations of the Honourable Kolobana to put to, I think we'll have to come back.
Can I just interrupt you if we have to start it, because I think I immediately have a follow-up question on that, and probably will request SAPS to respond immediately. You know, SAPS, according to the Constitution, I have expected to uphold and enforce law. Crime is committed in the presence of SAPS members. A person in Emedo is murdered during a protest march in the presence of SAPS members. But that case cannot go to court because there are no people who can be witnesses. They were SAPS members. As a matter of fact, people in the township there are alleging that it is SAPS members that shot and killed that person. It could be wrong, it could be right, but they were present. How does it happen that in the presence of law enforcers, people who have to uphold and enforce law, we have a problem in getting information and witnesses so that a person who is murdered and those responsible for that can actually go to court? How does it happen?
Thanks, Madam Chair. Madam Chair, I do not have the facts of a particular case, but generally, the police who actually witness the commission of a crime need to act. It doesn't matter who the accused is. If it is a colleague who directly commit that crime, they still need to act. If from the circumstances it dictates that it is a murder, and then some of the incidents may not from the way to go indicate that this one has got the element of intention to murder. A person can die as a result of a particular action, which is where investigation shall need to be undertaken. Which obviously the public prosecutor shall have to determine as to whether they are prepared with the evidence at hand to prosecute for murder. It is expected that our members, if the investigation is conducted by the ICD, our members should cooperate. And it is expected that our members should be submitting an affidavit to support what they have observed. So, unfortunately, I do not have the specific details as to exactly what could have transpired, but I'm just indicating generally how the investigation is approved. Thanks, Madam.
I think, Chairperson, this, and if you can look at our challenges and recommendations, this is actually part of the core of the problem, the issue of identification of members who are involved in this brutality. The reality of the situation is that when we engage in an investigation, if we are called to the scene, for instance, or when we are called to the scene and we arrive at the scene, normally there is reluctance on members to cooperate in terms of giving statements. I mean, you get situations where members say, no, we have to engage with our legal services and so forth. And especially, for instance, in the crowd control situation where we expect commanders who are taking charge of the situation to be able to be forthright with us in terms of what happened there, who gave instruction to do what, who are the members who shot and so forth. We don't get that information. And that is the reality of why most of our investigation or we are unable to prosecute where there is an unlawful conduct. And this tallies with the issue of what you see in our statistics, for instance, of low conviction rates and issues of cases that are declined to be prosecuted by the prosecutors. And when you look at our recommendations, exactly that, because the challenge is how do we identify those members? The issue of the TRT, for instance, what we get on the ground is that members of the community will tell you that it's TRT, but they cannot tell you who. When you go to the station, sometimes station commanders tell you that, no, these people are from head office, for instance. We don't know who came, but we know that it's TRC. Because you don't get a situation where they are deployed at a particular place, maybe they start there and introduce themselves, and you have a record of who came there and so forth. So these are the kind of challenges that you have, that you are told that TRT came in, but you don't know who are the people who really came in. So we have serious difficulty in terms of identification of those members. In terms of the case that you invest, in fact, most of the cases where we have had successes, we don't have a direct evidence. In fact, we are helped by circumstantial evidence and ballistics that are able to link, for instance, where they used live rounds, and we are able to link people ballistically with a specific death, or in the case of attempted murder, where maybe a bullet was lodged in a person and were able to retrieve that and ultimately be able to link them. But generally, in most cases, there is that difficulty of identification, and we investigate, we refer to the prosecutors, and they decline to prosecute. And when we discuss these issues with prosecutors, and hence we are saying in our recommendation that issues of recording of these incidents, for instance, this becomes very important. I mean, one of the successes in the Titanium matter was that there was also a recording, so it also helped, you know. So these are the things that if they are implemented, then there can be improvement in terms of this. I think also what is important in my view is that once members who attend this incident, they know that there will be accountability and they will be held accountable for whatever action they get involved in these events, then they will refrain from acting outside the law. But because they know now that there are no proper system in place to identify them, to make them accountable for their actions, and that is why they may continue to acting outside the framework of the law.
Chairperson, the Honourable Colonel Barnard referred to the 8% recommendations. I think we'll have to come back. I don't think we've got the specific detail. Then I'll just ask Mr. Lambini to deal with the issues of statistics as well as the TRT and KZN asked by Mr. Van Beck.
Thank you. If I may deal with the active cases, the 39 active cases, let me refer to slide number 9, Chair, which basically shows that out of the 204 cases, 35 occurred in 2010 and 40 occurred in 2011. So the bulk of the active cases are not from 2002, but they are more recent cases, particularly 2010 and 2011. Most of the 2010 cases are also completed. We are remaining with only a few from 2010 and then some from 2011. Some of the investigations from that were done in 2011 are also completed. Then the other question, in terms of the high numbers in Mpumalanga and KZN, here, Chairperson, the main reason is that some crowd control incidents occur over a period. In one instance, for instance, or a number of instances, you will find that a person or two people die in one incident, and then there is a funeral the following weekend. Again, the police are there, the crowd becomes rowdy, and then there are more fatalities. In fact, this happened in Balfour in 2010. So, what we are saying here is that one incident might have multiple fatalities or injuries emanating from that. The question on the TRT.
My concern is not, and I think the chair is in terms of Puma Longo. We can understand that one incident has multiple injuries or deaths, etc. But surely something must be alarming to us. Maybe we should redirect the question to SAPS as well. Why do we have in KwaZulu-Natal and Mpumalanga these high numbers of deaths?
Mm-hmm.
It indicates something is wrong. And whether it is because of that there's more violent nature in terms of the protests, which I doubt, or whether it is because of bad policing, I don't know. But there is something wrong in these two provinces. If you look at KwaZulu-Natal in terms of the other figures of the ICD, it also comes out tops in terms of deaths in custody, deaths as a result of police action. And we need to understand, why do we have this situation so that we can change it?
Thank you, Chair. yes, I think we agree with the committee on this one. We would have to perhaps look at those specifically, those incidents specifically. The other thing, Chair, I think the observations on the deployment of the TRT, perhaps that should be reconsidered because this unit is trained to deal with violent criminals and may not necessarily be suitable for deployment in a normal situation where people are just protesting about service delivery or whatever the situation may be.
Can I just direct that question to the who deploys TRT?
Madam Chair, they are being commanded by the TRT commanders at cluster level.
Can I ask again? I think when he made the presentation, he said sometimes the police, the station commander, will say, I did not know as to who was here because they came from the province or from wherever. Mm-hmm. Now, if it is at the cluster level, how is it possible that you're going to have such a situation where you will not know as to who was where? It sounds very problematic.
Quite true, Madam Chair, honorable members. In the normal circumstances, and the instructions are very clear for police officers, if you happen to go and operate in another station area or another jurisdiction out of your own jurisdiction, what we normally do, we report to the local police station, we make an OB entry, occurrence register, to say that here I am, I'm going to perform the following duties and so forth. Upon completion of the duties, go back to the station and then report that I'm done with my duties, off I go out of the area. This is what it is expected from all members of the police. And the cluster commander, when he plans his weekly activities, what they normally do, he sits with the station commanders. Because this TRT is central, it's in the cluster. So he needs to share the TRT with all the stations within the cluster. So they agree during their planning process to say that TRT will concentrate on this shopping mall or in these ATMs and so forth. This is what must happen. If it is not happening, it's something which you need to correct.
Have you checked in Mpumalanga in particular? Because figures and statistics is showing that there surely must be something wrong with regards to the utilization of TRT in Mpumalanga. Have you checked as to whether what you are saying is happening? Whether TRT is responding to circumstances that really need TRT to come and respond to. I just want to know, as a response team, is it responding to situations that demand of it to respond? I just want to check. What have you done as national office? Because surely it cannot be true that you're hearing this in this meeting.
Chair, my follow-up question is similar to yours. Practically, who would make the decision and give the command that we deploy a TRT unit to a public protest? Because I agree with the ICD's ICD's perception on this, that you don't use them in public protests. But we know that they have been used. They have been used. And who take that decision? Who practically gives that command? Because that's a wrongful deployment. And surely that, there I agree with the chairperson, you're not hearing it here for the first time. I would presume that you, the day it happened, intervened and say this shouldn't happen.
Thank you, Chairperson. You're quite right. It's not for the first time we hear this here in this room. We do hear those incidents whereby maybe they are not being properly utilized and so forth. And we have intervened on several occasions whereby we find out at times they're just being left on their own to can continue to do whatever they think that it will assist in terms of combating crime. And we have intervened in those circumstances. And whereby I've also made mention that the team led by General Mkhwanazi have been going out in provinces to can go and evaluate, to check the performance of all those units and try to address some of the things which we've identified. And among the others is this thing of whereby commanders, they are not strong enough to can command those members and they allow the members to do as they wish. We are busy addressing that. Public, with regard to crowd management, true, it is not their primary function to go and deal with crowd. If that particular commander or a cluster commander decide, for the purpose of force multiplier, he decide to call in the TRT there, it is wrong. He should not do that. The establishment, the sole responsibility of the TRT is to ensure that they deal with this violence crime. And this is what we expect even the commanders on the ground to can assist us deploy them accordingly.
Yeah, thank you. I think one other issue, the civilian secretariat, which I think definitely must be managed this time around, which maybe sub members may not see, is that TRT sometimes are misused by MECs, such that whether you are a commander at the police station level or cluster or province for that matter, you do not know what to do because the MEC has instructed the TRT to go to a particular area. And they remain helpless and useless somewhere, not knowing what to do because it's now a politician. Can we really have this recorded that the minister really deal with this matter? Because I think it is one of the challenges that are happening and they leave subs members so helpless as to what to do. Mm-hmm. Can we move on?
Chair, I think we've dealt with all the questions. Just one point on the same issue, Chair. In MLO, what we picked up, for instance, was that there were units from Nelspruit. There were units from Middleburg, National, and even Limpopo deployed there. So, in the end, it was difficult to then account for all the members in terms of where they come from, in terms of the various responsibilities that they were assigned. So, the issues of identification, again, the SAP 15. We asked, for instance, where is that? Do we know what firearms or equipment these members were issued with? How many members were deployed? It was difficult to get that information. So that issue needs to be addressed. Thank you, Chair.
I want to get the Pensap's response. It will probably extend it to how does it happen that you have people from different provinces coming to one area, MS. How does it happen? And who then remains accountable? Who orders that?
Thank you, Madam Chair. I take the responsibility. I'm the one who called the members from Limpopo and deployed in MLO. I do have the list of all those members who were deployed there. I also have the list of all the equipments which were issued to those members when they were deployed there. It's just a question of maybe we need to come up with some sort of a protocol. If they want information, maybe they don't get joy at grassroots level who at the next level they have to contact to ensure that they get the relevant information which they require. We didn't know that you are frustrated, you can't get that information. We didn't know about that. But I'm the one who called those people there through the call-up instruction. Go.
Can I therefore inform you, sir, that somebody was murdered during that protest march and during that intervention? Nobody so far has been arrested. A family buried a member who was shot and killed. Nobody is arrested so far.
Yes, Madam Chair, we are quite aware of that incident. It happened before we do the mobilization. We have done the mobilization realizing that the province itself could not handle the situation. That's when then I've mobilized members from elsewhere to come and stabilize the situation. We are quite aware of that incident, and we are quite aware that the ICD is investigating that incident. Can I continue, Madam Chair, with the answers? Maybe allow you to...
Thanks, sir. Madam Chair, honorable members, the general is going to deal with the answering of the questions, but I just have got a theory that I will deal with. Maybe firstly, in passing, the Chair have hinted on the investigation of the murder in Limpopo as to what is that which the police are doing to apprehend the perpetrators. Indeed, we are aware that that particular incident appeared to be linked with the more than one, where the modus operandi is the same. Our hawks are working on that one, although there is some indication as to who are the possible suspect. They are looking for evidence that when they do the confrontation, at least they have got some evidence. Currently, there is some information that they are working on, so they are linking some a few cases, also looking at why that had to happen. Madam Chair, the issue of crime intelligence as involvement, indeed, crime intelligence is supposed to be providing all the intelligence to ensure that our policing is intelligence-led. Most of the activities they do have information. I think even the current one that is taking place, I have seen the flow of the information from the various provinces indicating what are the possibilities. So we can't say that we have got all the information. We will be having pieces of information that from time to time we will need more. But they gather information which will never be enough. We are also building capacity in the intelligence environment as all the operational units need to be provided with information from intelligence that focus on various types of criminality. On the question of database of the people who are involved in some illegal activities, the creation of any database obviously will be informed by the conviction. Once a person has been found guilty of a particular offense, you are allowed by law to keep the information on data. That information from time to time when we work on individual, that is what we say we do profiling. That information we bank. So the information of those who have not been convicted, the information of innocent people is the one that you don't necessarily keep data on. So the keeping of data is available on people who have been convicted. And when they repeat, we always get that information. On the last one of the issue of policy, which is in the environment of the SAPS and the minister's environment, it might be a matter of utilization of the terminology policy. I think at various level, this terminology might be given a different interpretation. So while everything that we are doing is subject to the direction of the minister, there are indeed in the past where most of our documents, we have labeled them policy. Policy of the FCS, policy of the detective service. So various environments have got documents that are labeled policy. So some of these documents you find elsewhere been labeled national instruction. The national instruction is actually the implementation of a policy that shall have been designed. So I say that it may be a matter of the utilization of the word policy at various levels. So we will be dealing with that one so that there is no confusion in future. Thanks, Madam Chair. The General will deal with the rest of the questions.
Thank you, General. Thank you, Madam Chair and Honourable Members. The issue of the Belgium and the French model, we are in agreement with what the Secretariat has mentioned. We are in agreement with that. The issue of a member who was not wearing a bulletproof jacket, it's a concern because the instruction was recently been issued to all members that it is compulsory for all functional members to be in uniform when they operate. It's an unfortunate situation whereby we had that particular member within that grouping without the relevant bulletproof jacket. But the instruction was issued to all members.
Can I ask the generals who are here to follow up, because I can guarantee you, the secretary was with me in the one day, that there are members that are deployed at the parliament who have never been issued bulletproof vests.
Okay.
Never been issued bulletproof vests.
Okay.
Well,
okay. Thank you, we'll do so. With regard to the ballistic testing of firearms, the instruction was also issued that all the firearms need to be tested, the IBS. And I don't think that the ops members will be treated differently. As members of the SABS, they are subjected to all the instructions issued by the National Commission. Maintenance of the equipment, the NYALAS, what we were trying to say, Madam Chair and Honourable Members, is that after we changed the focus from public order to focusing more on crime prevention, we had these armored vehicles, the NYALAS, of which those vehicles are not ideal for normal crime prevention in the streets and so forth. So majority of those vehicles were just kept in the backyard of whatever police station or the unit and so forth, no longer being taken care of in terms of maintenance and so forth. That's what we're trying to explain. The issue of procurement of relevant equipment for crowd control was no longer a priority. Priority was equipment which can be used for day-to-day crime prevention. That's what I was trying to explain when I talk about the maintenance of all this equipment and so forth. The issue of how many POPs commanders and who attended the OCT course, unfortunately I don't have that information in my disposal, but will gladly respond in writing to your office, Madam Chair, to give the details. The role of intelligence, General Lebeya spoken about it. The issue of the gathering of the ANC Youth League. Yes, we knew, as from last week, that they will be coming to the Thule House. And we did issue instruction to the province to say that engage all the role players and start planning to get all the facts. It was reported to me to say that planning is taking place. The last meeting happened Sunday, 12 o'clock at the Thule House, whereby all role players sit around the table to plan to see to it that how are they going to manage this situation. Unfortunate part of it is that the dynamics of gathering, it's something which maybe they didn't take care of, thinking that maybe it's going to be a peaceful gathering whereby the youth league will be protesting against the mother body, but not to start fighting with the mother body. I don't know. But we'll get the effects as soon as the debriefing report is compiled and sent to us as to what transpired, why this thing went out of control. We don't know. But the proper planning in terms of the second section floor, it was constituted.
Chair, can I
Could I ask then, it just seems to me that you just said that your planning then was a failure. You've just said you had no idea it was going to be a violent, out of control exercise. You told us you were intelligence driven. We've just been told everything you do is intelligence driven. Now, how can you not know what's going to happen if you are indeed intelligence driven, and will you use this as a training exercise, because it's been a debacle?
Madam Chair, honorable members, as we speak, this is still continuing. We don't have the debriefing report as to what transpired. As soon as we get the debriefing report, we'll know exactly what transpired. If things went wrong, we'll know what was the reason thereof. And then whatever best practices have implemented, we'll also know. But currently, it is still on. Planning, it went through. We got the information, and then the members who were responsible for that planning, they plan around the information which they received at that point in time.
Just to follow up there, please. Yes, I have heard Honorable Kolapana saying that this gathering is illegal. You haven't responded to that yet.
Thanks. As far as we know, it is not an illegal gathering. There was an application which was served. It's not an illegal gathering. The issue of the SAP 15, I think we have already touched on that it is expected that each and every member, when he's been deployed, will complete the SAP 15 and then is linked to the OB entry and so forth. It needs to be done like that. And the equipment, all the equipment issued to the members, it must also be listed at the back of the SAP 15. The issue of unplanned gathering, why do we allow them to continue? I think my colleague, the secretariat, she also touched on that to say that at times it's best not to disperse those people because of we can cause chaos. It's better to allow them to try to guide them and allow them to continue until to the end. Because once we start implementing the olden days kind of tactics whereby we said it's an illegal gathering, 5 minutes you disperse and we start shooting, it may cause more damage than what we intended to. So that is the reason why at times we allow them to get it. Continue. Okay, the French issue, it was touched by the secretariat. The issue of slide number 12, whereby honorable members spoke about, we said the lack of video. There we were mentioning the equipment which we have in our mobilization center. But the units they do have, as I've said, that some of those equipments are outdated. You find that they are not utilizing this kind of a video machine, but it's this smaller Nyana ones and so forth. Our intention is to upgrade and ensure that we buy the recent equipment which is relevant for the situation right now. The issue of permission to march. The police, we don't give permission to or refuse permission to march. It's the responsibility of the local government. And actually, the people, they are not applying for permission. They give notice to march. And then the local government, they say it's fine, you can march and so forth. We participate in the Section 4 meeting whereby we highlight all the risk sectors going with that particular march and so forth, and also raise our concern if there is any. But surely our responsibility is to ensure that people, they march peacefully, and we assist them, protect them from whatever, and also protect other people who are not involved in the march. The issue of taking responsibility by all role players. Yes, we are not alone in this. That is why we have this Section 4 meeting. There is a convener, there is a local government, there is a police in terms of arranging this march or gathering and so forth. Surely we believe that each and every role player in that particular Section 4 meeting must be able to take responsibility for his success and failure. So if we have failed as a police, we need to to have guts to say that we have failed in these circumstances. And if it's a failure on the part of the convener or the person who have organized this march, he or she must also be in the position to can say that we didn't adhere to all the conditions which we have agreed upon in those things. Not to say we are trying to can shun away from our responsibility as the police to enforce the law. That was not the intention of my...
I'm saying I have to stop you with your respect. I have a meeting at 1:15. And really apologize for that. We read a presentation from three very important units or departments today. I think the Civilian Secretariat has presented a policy on crowd control. For us, this means that whatever that will be done by SAPS members will be informed by that policy. At least we now have a guiding document which all of us can adhere to and can actually want to implement. And that, I think, we are appreciating. I think the ICD here, in fact, the IP, presented figures that are saying that there is gradual increase in the reported brutality of police or by police, and also that the conviction rate is quite low. Of course, they highlighted their frustrations and issues that are leading to that. One of them, which I think is frightening, is the fact that there is lack of command and control, and I think that is something worried if it is said about that. But of course, one good thing is that the IP is able to outline these issues and make recommendations, and I think that is quite positive. General Mawela presented made a very vibrant presentation, and for me it was like it's somebody who knows what to do and probably has been in the field for quite some time. I think he came across as this person who is ambitious and want to correct the situation. I have no reasons, I've never met you before, and therefore have no reasons to doubt what you are saying. I really don't, and therefore will not doubt what you are saying. I want to believe that you want to see this very difficult situation by better managed, because indeed it would be naive of all of us here to pretend as if dealing with these protest marches that change just within a wink of an eye is an easy thing to do. But I think the presentation for now is making us to probably say we are cautiously optimistic and looking forward to the implementation of the policy that was presented here to us without any confusion, but also taking into cognizance what IP is raising as issues that I think can be corrected going forward, so that we can actually see some improvement in the manner in which you intervene in these issues that all of us we think are a problem. We therefore will be monitoring this. We'll be monitoring it because, as you rightfully said, it will be because of the employer who is not agreeing to increase the salary to this percentage. But when it is a protest march, then it becomes a subset. It will be the local municipality that probably has not provided some service. But immediately there's a protest march, then it changes everything. It then becomes the subset. And it is indeed worrying because somehow we think that sometimes are unjustly condemned for things that in fact should go to other people, for condemnation that should be directed to other people. However, you are expected to uphold and to enforce law. And that is one unfortunate thing we cannot run away from. And therefore, I'm saying here, General Libya, we will definitely be monitoring the implementation of the policy that was presented here today, and with keen interest, and we have no reason not to believe that you're going to implement it after the presentation today. But again, let me say here that when you come back in future and you have implemented the policy as you have said today, or as you have presented it to us today, we'll never hesitate to say, well done, we are happy. But again, if you do not, we'll not hesitate to say you have failed. We never hesitate to do that. So it's all in your hands, the ball is in your court, and we really are wishing you well as you implement this in a very difficult situation, that of protest marches. Thank you very much for the meeting and all of you who are here, and the meeting is closed.